Okay, thank you for being here today. My name is Paul Brigner. I'm the Regional Bureau Director of North America for the Internet Society. And this is the 2012 New York INET. And we have a nice crowd here, but we have a very nice crowd online too. So everything we do today is about getting your input and as well as getting input from our remote channel. I just want to first welcome you all. Thank you for being here. I've got a couple thank yous I have to say. I've had some great support from the New York chapter in doing this event. We've worked together on this for a long time now. And in particular, David Solomonoff is the president. He deserves some credit for this. And also Jolly McPhee deserves a lot of credit because he helped publicize this event. I need to thank our ISOC staff, in particular Nicole is here, Nicole Armstrong. She did a great work in helping organize this event. So, and the New York Law School, because this is an awesome venue for this event. So that's that. So we're here for an INET, but I think it's whenever I'm at an event for the Internet Society, I always like to start off by making sure that everyone knows who we are and what our mission is. So let me just read that to you briefly. We are a global nonprofit organization dedicated to ensuring the open development, evolution, and use of the benefit for all people around the world. Since 1992, ISOC has served as the global clearinghouse for technically sound, unbiased information about the internet, as an educator, and as a focal point for a broad-based community of interest engaged in internet-related initiatives around the world. We provide the organizational home for the Internet Engineering Task Force, the Internet Architecture Board, and the Internet Research Task Force. As well, we just launched the Internet Hall of Fame this year. So there's a lot of good things going on at the Internet Society. And if you are not a member, and I suspect all of you are, but if you are not, I highly encourage you to join because you will be supporting the internet and events like this. So please do so. There's a free membership option. So really, there's no reason not to join if you're a believer in this initiative. See, I also wanted to mention that we have more than 55,000 members around the world and 90 chapters, over 130 organizational members. So we are very active globally. Speaking of our activities around the world, we actually are having another INET in Singapore tomorrow and the next day. And I thought that was kind of interesting to mention because that might be more of a characteristic type of INET that we have. I just want to mention that real quick. I thought the topic was kind of interesting. It's about SLOLOMO. And it's the first time I've heard this acronym, but it's about social, local, and mobile, highlighting the convergence of social media, location-aware technology, and mobile devices. So it gives you an idea of what we might do with some INETs. And I think that this INET is particularly interesting because it's a little different than covering a broad topic. It's covering digital content as an issue, but in particular, it's covering the copyright alert system, which is a very interesting system that is launching soon. We're going to learn all about it today, so I'm not even going to try to describe it to you because I would probably get it wrong, and we have all the experts here who are going to tell us exactly what it is. But it is unprecedented to have internet service providers, content providers, and others working together to help the internet content be delivered in a way that hopefully is beneficial to the internet ecosystem. And that's what we're going to learn and be able to possibly determine for ourselves. So as a personal note, I like to address difficult questions head on. We're addressing some difficult questions here today, but personally, I'm very interested in this topic as well. I think a lot of you know that I have a background of having worked for Verizon, as well as the Motion Picture Association of America, and now at the Internet Society. So I kind of blend a lot of the different topics that are being discussed today, and I want to make it clear that while this is a topic that is very much of interest to me, The Internet Society does not have a position on the copyright alert system. So we are also not encouraged by any of the organizations here to do this event as a service to them. We are doing this as a service to the internet community. And first and foremost, we're doing it at the encouragement of our New York City chapter. So if there's any question about that, I hope that puts that to rest, because this is about keeping you informed and making sure that when there is a significant activity that's happening on the internet, we know what it is and we know what kind of effect it's going to have. So with that, I would like to invite David Solomonoff, the president of the New York chapter, to come up and say a few comments to help kick us off. So David, thank you.
Okay, hi, I'm David Solomonoff, president of the Internet Society New York chapter. I'd like to welcome everybody here to the INET New York Open Forum on the Copyright Alert System, sometimes called the Six Strikes Program, which will kick off on November 28th. Internet access is a necessity of modern life and is being seen as a human right in some countries now. That's obviously the trend. Intellectual property has become an economic asset that is at least or more valuable than physical property. So in this context, restricting or removing internet access for a person as punishment for copyright infringement is analogous to the loss of freedom due to incarceration. Therefore, an internet copyright enforcement regimen that includes restricting or blocking internet access must both be effective and minimize harm. To be effective, and must provide equal protection to all, so not only protect big media content creators, big media companies, but other content creators with more limited financial and legal resources must be protected as well. Also, content creators who choose to share their works with specific requirements and restrictions on their reuse must also be protected. So open source software developers or creative content license, artistic works that require specific types of attribution, although they are allowed to be shared, that type of license must be enforced as well. It's necessary to minimize harm. So we must assume innocence until guilt is proven, as we do in our current legal system. We must have due process. We must provide adequate means of redress, including recompense for damage caused by false accusations of copyright infringement. But some types of loss, damage, injury, or even death may be impossible to compensate, or if a specious or abusive accusation of infringement caused even a brief delay in the dissemination of time-sensitive information. So examples would be a whistleblower warning of negligence in infrastructure maintenance before a storm, a political dissident planning a mass protest or warning of possible voter fraud before an election, the failure of internet-connected burglar alarms, fire alarms, or medical devices, time-sensitive financial transactions which cannot be completed in a timely manner. The fear of accusation for infringement must also not have a chilling effect on innovation or free expression, including fair use, satire or parody, transformative creative use such as mashups, remixes, and so forth. So today we're going to have a multi-stakeholder dialogue about these issues, which includes media companies, ISPs, internet and civil liberties activists, to determine how the copyright alert system meets these requirements, and if it doesn't, how it could be changed to do so. Thank you.
Thank you very much, David. We appreciate that. So I have a big favor to ask you. We already have a large group of people online watching right now, but if you're online in the room, and for those of you that are online, please take a moment to tweet for us and let others know that this event's happening. If you're trying to get on the internet here in the room, there is a password, user ID and password is visitor, okay? So that will get you on. By the way, since we're talking about in the room logistics, we do want a lot of input from the room, but when you push the buttons for the microphone, you have to push it to speak, and then you have to push it to turn it off, okay? Because if you do not turn it off, then the next person can't activate their microphone, all right? All right, so our hashtag for today is INETNY or copyright. So please use those hashtags. We are having a back channel question system that's available for you to either submit questions or to vote up and down questions, which is at inetny.backchan.nl. So it's backchannel, backchan.nl. And finally, when you do tweet, make sure you put in the live stream video, which is bit.ly/ISOCTV, bit.ly/ISOCTV. So enough of that. I would like to now turn over to my colleague, Konstantinos Komedis. He came all the way from Geneva. He is part of our public policy team at the Internet Society, and he is going to talk a little bit about some of, or he's going to frame, I should say, some of the public policy issues that are going to be addressed here, and I think that will be very helpful to us all. So, Konstantinos.
Thank you, Paul, and good afternoon to all of you. So, in 2009, France introduced Hadopi, a law especially designed to curb online copyright piracy. Hadopi was the first of a subsequent wave of legislation across the world to take the extreme position of disconnecting people from the internet, essentially cutting them off from what former US President Bill Clinton has characterized an integral part of economic, political, and social life. Since then, various jurisdictions around the world have begun to look into ways to address copyright infringement, the form of unauthorized downloading of copyrighted material through peer-to-peer networks. What makes these laws interesting is that although they all seek to address the same issue, they do so at different degrees and levels. Some, like Hadopi, are purely public in nature and have to adhere to basic constitutional imperatives. Others, like the self-regulatory system enforced by IRCOM in Ireland, take a more or less fair approach and have been criticized for lacking the necessary constitutional or other due process safeguards. In fact, Frank Leroux, UN Rapporteur on Freedom of Expression, has frequently stated his distress by proposals to disconnect users from internet access if they violate intellectual property rights, citing three strikes laws specifically and condemning such frameworks as human rights violations. All these indicate part of the struggles the internet community has been facing in trying to identify ways to address the tension that appears to exist between intellectual property rights and the way they are expressed in the internet space. This, as we are all witnessing, has turned out to be a much more difficult task than any of us originally anticipated. So, at the one side of the spectrum, the content industry in the form of producers and everyone else involved in the process of creating content are asserting that copyright infringement is having a significant impact on business models and the economy. Users and civil society, on the other hand, have raised their voice on the impact strict copyright regimes are having on basic fundamental rights and civil liberties, such as freedom of expression, free speech, and due process. Somewhere in the middle are technology companies, which have taken the view that laws, regulations, and policies should not use the internet, its technologies, and platforms in order to cure copyright infringement. Another approach is necessary, they argue, if the internet is to continue to evolve organically. In a similar vein, internet service providers have so far resisted legislative attempts that seek to unconditionally turn them into supervisors of content. But this resistance is also wearing thin. And so here we are. The unsuccessful attempt of the United States to pass copyright legislation in the form of SOPA and PIPA last year, as well as the overwhelming rejection of ACTA by the European Parliament in July, manifested two things. The first one was that intellectual property is unequivocally part of a much larger discussion, a discussion that necessitates the inclusion of everybody who is concerned with or has vested interests on the internet. The second was that traditional forms of legislation, regulations, directives, treaties, conventions, are not always best suited to address the complexities and particularities of copyright law. Given this, and seeking to address copyright piracy, five of the largest ISPs in the United States have entered a memorandum of understanding with trade groups representing major copyright owners. Amongst the various issues the MOU seeks to tackle, it has also authorized the creation of the Center of Copyright Information, the body responsible for the macro-management of the copyright alert system. Based on self-regulatory archetypes, the copyright alert system is a privately designed and administered enforcement mechanism which will be incorporated in a contractual agreement between broadband providers and users. One of the key characteristics and a key difference of the copyright alert system is that it does not seek, at least explicitly, as an end goal to suspend users' internet connections, thus cutting them off the network. The Internet Society is generally in favor of industry-based initiatives to address various issues, including those relating to intellectual property. As self-regulation refers to initiatives produced and enforced by independent bodies or trade associations, we feel that such private entities could prove beneficial in overseeing market participants' actions through different processes such as standard setting, certification, monitoring, brand approval, warranties, product evaluation, and arbitration. For self-regulatory mechanisms to be successful, they should include standards for real consent, this way setting in motion a contractual matrix of private regulation. In cases where consent is not present, public legal institutions are required to specify the criteria that entitle private regulatory regimes to acquiescence and immunity. But ultimately, it is important to understand that all initiatives based on self-regulation are expected to operate under minimum standards of justice and fairness. Rules consequential to private regulatory efforts should provide equal opportunities to the distribution of an institution's shares. With this in mind, private regulation offers some notable advantages in ensuring that the fundamental values, which normally are at stake in the construction of cyberspace, can be protected by allowing interested parties to participate in the formation of rules and principles that are not subject to the cumbersome nature of traditional lawmaking. As Professor Post accurately put it, we don't need a plan, but a multitude of plans from among which individuals can choose, and the market is most likely to bring that plenitude to us. In a much similar vein, Robert Pitofsky, a former chair of the Federal Trade Commission, referring to industry-led regulation, enumerated the following advantages. Self-regulatory groups may establish efficient product standards. Private standard setting can lower the cost of production. Private regulation helps consumers evaluate products and services. Self-regulation may deter conduct that is universally considered undesirable but outside the purview of civil or criminal law. And finally, self-regulation is more prompt, flexible, and effective than government regulation. However, industry regulation has also some significant disadvantages. In particular, some scholars have challenged the legitimacy of the authorities created to deal with issues emanating from cyberspace. Their main concern relates to the ability of such authorities to create policy and enforce rules that traditionally fall within the democratic state. Given this understanding, one of the most worrying aspects of private regulation is arguably that many of its advantages are based on false premises and loose criteria. Amongst other things, private regulation may easily fail to protect democratic values. It can neglect basic standards of justice. It is often less accountable compared to traditional governmental rulemaking. And because of the internet, it is increasingly and mostly inflicted through computer code, which by nature circumvents legal and political institutions that ideally ensure just and democratic values. On this basis, a concern of private regulation refers to issues of accountability, or its lack thereof, and to the fact that no mechanism, be it governmental or self-regulatory, can be allowed to weave around the imposition of duties of due process and equal protection through the creation of formally private intermediaries for policymaking. Because of these challenges, the Internet Society believes that all issues of policy related to the Internet should be deliberated and discussed under a multi-stakeholder framework. Intellectual property is one such issue. The experience of SOPA, PIPA, and ACTA have aided this understanding and have manifested the need for all actors, government, civil society groups, businesses, and the technical community to be part of a wider collective discussion, a discussion that seeks to find ways to address these issues without affecting the internet and its underlying technologies, without sacrificing the existing rights of intellectual property owners or putting in jeopardy hard-fought fundamental liberties. This was essentially the message communicated in 2005 during the World Summit on Information Society in Tunis, where heads of states considered it important for all issues pertaining to the internet to be detached from traditional rulemaking and to become part of a new governance arrangement that is based on cooperation, collaboration, and partnership. Under the Tunis agenda, internet governance is to unambiguously be conducted through a multi-stakeholder framework where each stakeholder participates on an equal footing, offering different perspectives. We feel that the Tunis agenda of the WISI should constitute the foundation and the basis for all future policy work in this space. And like Paul, I am very much looking forward to a robust discussion and to learn more about the self-regulatory system. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Konstantinos. So without any further delay, I would like to invite our first moderator to come up, Declan McCullough. He is the chief political correspondent for CNET. And he and our other moderator, Jeff Jarvis, have been selected because they are very vocal in their views. They're very independent in their views, and they always do a good job of informing the internet community about what's going on, and we appreciate their work. So, Declan, thanks.
Hi, and thanks for coming. My name is Declan McCullough. I cover technology, law, public policy for CNET, and I spent 10 years in D.C., and now I'm out on the West Coast, and I've been covering copyright for far too long since I actually remember some of the original Digital Millennium Copyright Act debates from the 1990s. So we have two panels today, and this one is probably more of a descriptive one. This is actually how the system works, and the next one we're going to hear from some advocacy groups. Now everyone up here likes the system. Everyone on the next panel may not like it as much. There's not going to be a whole lot of internal dissension, I suspect, unless I do a really good job and can try to provoke them. Jill, I think it makes the most sense for you to go first, unless you have a strong preference otherwise. You're going to be running this. You already are running this. In a few minutes, you can't. I'm sorry. How is this going to work at a high level? Is it six strikes, six complaints, and then I get my internet connection pulled, or is it something more benign than that?
You're just baiting me with the six strikes. It's
absolutely
right?
Baiting.
Do I have to start there? Hello. I am Jill Lesser. I am the executive director of the Center for Copyright Information, which was set up under the Memorandum of Understanding to help manage the copyright alert system and also develop an educational program around copyright going forward. Just a bit about my background, because one of the reasons why it's really interesting for me to sit here is because I spent most of my career on the internet side of policy and politics, being the first policy director at AOL starting in 1996, when the Communications Decency Act was first introduced, and then ended up at AOL Time Warner briefly, since that merger was only briefly in place, trying to meet in the middle between the content and the internet or distribution brands of that large company. So I've been around these issues for a long time and was intrigued by a coming together around trying to find some solutions in a narrow space around copyright issues. And I know there is certainly a lot of skepticism out there, but I am excited about what we're doing. And I think pleasantly surprised by how much work and contemplation and commitment has gone into this process from both sides. Let me start by saying the copyright alert system in its, sort of where we are today. So the MOU was announced in July of 2011, and we have been working for just over 15 months for implementation. And the reason we've been working for 15 months towards implementation is because we primarily want to get this right. And getting it right for us means a couple of things. It means, number one, trying to make sure that we are using technical methodologies and approaches that minimize the tagging of content that is not, in fact, copyrighted and is not, in fact, being shared, distributed over peer-to-peer networks without proper authorization. We also want to make sure that as the content owners are out there looking for their content and notifying the appropriate ISPs based on internet protocol addresses, that the ISPs on the other side are appropriately and protecting privacy, while protecting privacy, identifying the correct subscriber, and then passing these alerts onto those people, onto the primary account holders. And I think it's important to note that our notices are going to the primary account holders who may or may not be the person engaged in the activity. So first and foremost is putting in a set of methodologies that minimize false positives and make sure that we're getting to the right people. The second thing, and this really was something that came out of our putting together a consumer advisory board, which was mandated in the MOU, but sort of having it come to life has given us an enormous amount of ability to really focus on what's important, and that is to go out in a research-based environment and talk to consumers. You know, what does copyright even mean? Why do people regularly think it's fine to simply trade in copyrighted material?
Well, let me cut you off there because this is we have a good high-level overview. But now let's switch to for a Hollywood view. How about Ben from the MPAA? How are you going to actually track down people who, the users of these ISPs who are accused of violating copyright? There's a third-party company, Mark Monitor. You're going to outsource to them. They're going to flag, is a human going to review every instance of a complaint, independently review, or just sort of rubber stamp? How's this going to work?
Well, thanks, Declan, for having us. The methodologies, although the copyright alert system in the form that it's about to launch is new, really the methodologies and the sort of means of enforcement and notice sending are really not new. Copyright owners, movie studios, and record companies have been doing this for really over a decade. And at a very high level, what it means is, what it entails is joining publicly accessible peer-to-peer networks and seeing what is in individual peers, individual users' shared folder, which they voluntarily expose to the world by joining peer-to-peer networks. You don't know their names, but you know their IP addresses, and you know the files that they're sharing with the world. From that, there are very, I'm not going to go into great detail, all this stuff is publicly available through CCI's website, but basically there are methodologies for downloading and verifying that the files are indeed.
So then Mark Monitor connects to their shared folder, downloads everything, and then determines whether it's a real copy? Is that...
Not everything.
It's going to do like an MD5 hash? Is it something like that?
Basically, yes. They're not looking at every...
It's a SHA-1 hash.
Close enough? Okay.
Yes, they're not looking at everything. You know, the copyright owners who are participating in the system specify different files that they're actually looking for. Those are then verified that they actually are the files through a combination of human and technical means. At that point, the our monitoring service sends along what we refer to as a copyright notice to the ISP. The ISP then matches the IP address with subscriber information, and then they send what is known as a copyright alert from the ISP to the individual user.
And, Victoria, did you want to add anything? I mean, is this the same system that you're going to use? Mark Monitor is representing you as well. And by you, I mean the Recording Industry Association of America and your member companies.
Yes. Do I have to turn this on first, or is it on the right?
Sounds like it's on.
Yes, we are both MPA and RIAA, on behalf of our content members, are using Mark Monitor. The Mark Monitor system uses metadata to initially identify a file that is publicly available on a P2P network. If it suspects that file is a copyright file that's owned by one of our member companies or the indies or the my indies on my side, they will download the first instance of the file, check it to make sure it is in fact all or substantially all of the copyrighted work at issue. In our case, they run it through Audible Magic. What's called a Type 3 monitoring through Audible Magic Fingerprint, which checks the entire file to make sure it matches on an audio fingerprint basis with the copyrighted work. They take the hash value of that file, and then they will check for hashes on a subsequent basis. And as I'm sure many of you know, the SHA-1 hash is virtually unique to each particular file.
So if I twiddle a bit, the whole purpose of a hash algorithm is if I change one bit in the file, then the resulting hash is wildly different. If I just change one bit of the file, if I'm a pirate, then I'm going to throw off your hash detection feature.
That is absolutely right. If you take the same CD, in our case, and rip it on two different computers, the track that's on the two different computers, the file, will have a different hash.
And so then, well, let's go into countermeasures from the pirate's perspective later. But Ron, you're at Fox. I mean, you love this system, or do you really love this system? What's the answer?
Let's see, I sort of really love it. Actually, we, as Ben alluded to, we've been sending notices to ISPs as part of commercial arrangements and otherwise for many, many years. And so we've developed the same methodologies for identifying within it with a high degree of confidence the files and the terms on which they will be forwarded to the subscribers for many years. Actually, the reason I said sort of really is under those commercial arrangements, frankly, we were allowed to send more files, more notices to the individual ISPs than our share. We haven't really talked about that yet, but there's actually an allocated share for, I think it's divided up by sector, as I recall, between the movie studios and the record companies and the other participants in the system. So we're actually having to reduce our share of notices, but in exchange, of course, we get a very broad adoption across more ISPs, more content owners. The overall number of notices sent by all content owners will clearly be higher under this system. So because it is a primarily an educational system, there will be more education of consumers as a result of this system than our piecemeal approach afforded us in years past. And for that reason, we're willing to accept that fewer notices regarding Fox movies and TV shows will be sent.
Ron, can I get you to say that the ISPs aren't doing enough? Because it wasn't, maybe I can break up this system by us. But it wasn't that long ago that I remember Verizon was fighting content owners in court. This is before the DC Circuit. This was a DMCA turbocharged subpoena process. Verizon was standing up. They said, and users liked it for the privacy of their users. And the content owners said, "Come on, Verizon, what are you doing? Turn over the user information." Should they be doing more? Should it be like a three strikes? I know it's not really a six strikes, but are they not going far enough?
Well, I mean, that dispute, as maybe everyone's aware of it, but just to briefly remind people or tell people who aren't, that involved the subpoena provision of the DMCA, which was a method for obtaining details for purposes of filing lawsuits against the subscribers. And Verizon obviously believed it was unconstitutional, I believe, was their claim, and I think they prevailed, as I recall. This is not about suing users at all. This is a completely different system.
So if any users get sued, they can take that to court and say, well, this isn't supposed to be about suing us. Well, will any users ever be sued as a result of this?
I have no idea, but that saying that this system is not designed to produce lawsuits. Designed to produce education.
Well, I mean, I think we can say pretty confidently that nobody will be sued as part of this system. Suing anybody is not part of this system.
Because you don't need the system to sue them.
Of course.
We've been doing this for time.
There have been many, many lawsuits.
The D.C. Circuit did not strike down old-fashioned John Doe subpoenas. So those still exist.
And I don't think the system is going to make it any easier for anyone to sue. So.
Nor will it make it any more difficult, I suspect. So we've heard the sort of the beginning of the process in terms of how allegedly infringing files are going to be identified. Let's hear the other end of the process. Link from Verizon, when you get from Jill and her Center for Copyright Information, when you get a notice, how do you respond? Are you going to do any due diligence, any checking to see whether or not there's any evidence of previous infringing activity? How do you respond?
One of the aspects of the system, Declan, that's important is that we built in a number of protections for consumers. So if they get a notice and they believe that it was incorrect, that they weren't doing anything wrong, there is an appeals process built in. So no, we don't check this. The copyright owners have done looked at their system. We've had an independent check of it to make sure it's as accurate as possible.
Who did the independent check?
what was the name of the firm?
It was Strauss Friedberg.
Right. So, and the intent of that was to make sure it was as accurate as possible. So, no, we do not. In our case, there would be between 4 and 6 notices would be sent out. There's an education phase. The first 2 notices would be education, basically sending a notice to the customer saying that there's been an allegation that you're doing some illegal activity with material that's copyrighted. And we also send a voicemail alert as well. So it's not just an email. We also send them a voicemail.
Are you going to send a physical letter to their billing address? Or does it depend on maybe how far along you are in the escalation?
Not in the first phase. It's email, and there's a voicemail alert. Levels 3 and 4 are what we call the acknowledgement phase, and this is where there is some kind of a pop-up. We haven't designed all this yet, but there would be a pop-up in this phase where it would actually say, acknowledge that you've gotten this email, this content.
So you, as in, you can't do anything else until you get that pop-up?
Okay. You have to acknowledge it. And understandably, part of what we're trying to do here is educate people and also alert them, because there are cases where people are in group homes, for example, and they could have one account and 5 people are using it. So it's very possible that somebody's doing this and the other people in the house don't know it. And somebody actually owns the account and they're the ones who are accountable for it.
Same thing
in a family where you'd have a mother and, or a father paying for the account, the kids could be doing it. So. And then there's a level 5 and 6, which is the mitigation phase. And in our case, what would happen there would be a temporary speed reduction, 2 to 3 day speed reduction. They would be given a 14-day advance notice. So keep in mind, this is after a long process of saying, we've got repeated notices, you've acknowledged the pop-up, which again, they could just click on, and again, it could be somebody in the house that didn't even have anything to do with it, or it could be somebody who did do it. And then there's a right of appeal as a result in this last phase, where they could say, look, it's not me, there's an independent arbitration firm we're working with AAA that would actually do the
cost of the appeal. Someone has to pay for it.
There would be a $35 filing fee, but it could be waived if they say they can't afford it. Obviously, if they won, they would get the fee.
So there was a leaked. I know you don't work for AT&T. I know there's a difference between the two companies, but there was a leaked AT&T internal training manual that, on the torrentfreak.com site, and it said that access to many of the most frequently visited websites will be restricted until during some of the upper phases of this. Are you going to do the same thing? I mean, that's like the Pirate Bay restriction, right?
Ours is a speed reduction. It's 2 to 3 days, so it doesn't last forever. It lasts for a period of time. The idea, again, is education, letting them know what's going on, and that kind of speed reduction is intended to get their notice, get them to say, is this something that happened or not? And if it's not, then obviously appeal it and say, and we can work it out that way.
Fernando, maybe I can bring you into the discussion. You're at Time Warner Cable. How is your response going to be similar or different from Verizon or the leaked AT&T internal training document?
I haven't seen the leaked document, but Declan, before I answer your question, I'm still struck by Constantino's opening remarks and appreciate, you know, how you framed this, because that was very profound, and I want to assure you that that's exactly the kind of overall framing in terms of the seriousness of the issues with which our internal conversations about this project have taken place, and certainly with the advice of the Consumer Advisory Board that we have at CCI. But to get to your question, Declan, each of the participating ISPs has a different approach for this educational program, and ours is comparable to Verizon's, but we have, a notice phase where we're going to send notices, 2 notices to the primary account holder, an acknowledgement phase where there has to be some sort of acknowledgement received, a click through, and then...
Does that mean that just web browsing is restricted? Or let's say I have an alarm monitoring system that is going to use a different port entirely. Are all ports cut off or just port 80?
Just the web browsing for purposes of an interface through which a customer can acknowledge that they have received the alert.
So in other words, my alarm system or
correct.
Heart monitor is going to keep working.
Or VoIP.
The better example even.
The goal.
The MOU specifically mandates that those kinds of services cannot be affected by any mitigation measure.
So the goal then is in our mitigation phase, what we're constructing is essentially a landing area, a soft landing area where the customer is restricted in the type of browsing that they can do until they either acknowledge or participate in the appeal process. If they're participating in the appeal process, then all of those measures are suspended pending the outcome of the appeal.
Hey, well, could I make another point? Because this is the Internet Society, and we're members. Teresa Swenner from my company is on the board. We believe in what the Internet Society is about. And one of the things they're working on now, which we're working very hard with them on, and a lot of people in this room are working on it too, is the ITU meeting that's coming up, and the importance of multi-stakeholderizations in the Internet and not having government mandates and regulation. And to me, this is an example of another one of those multi-stakeholder approaches where players get together, no government actually mandates it, there's not laws involved, trying to work out some kind of process to help deal with a problem on the Internet. And it's another example of how to do that. So I think in that sense, it's also positive, and it's something that I believe is in the spirit of what the Internet Society is all about.
Hold that thought. We'll get to Q&A in a sec. But also, it's a wonderful event today that the Internet Society is putting together. There aren't enough of them, and so I just wanted to say thank you to the Internet Society for putting this on. Let me see how much time we have, because we started a little late. Paul, anyone?
20 minutes.
We've got about 20 minutes left. So let me ask one or two questions, and then you folks may know much more about it, and I already see someone jumping up at the mic. So just give me about 3 minutes. Okay, we have VPNs. We have Tor. If someone's using a VPN or Tor, this thing ain't going to work, right? So does this just push the more determined pirates into a darker, more black area of the Internet? And so you just catch kind of the loser ones who aren't that smart?
So this program is really not structured to try to address serial pirates who are intentionally trying to circumvent intellectual property protection. I think where we are aiming is not low. It is at what we believe are the vast majority of people for whom trading in copyrighted material has become sort of a social norm. And over the course of many years, everybody sort of trades their music. It's something that, we used to trade mixtapes, if anyone's as old as I am. And this is kind of, in some ways, for some people, has become the natural evolution. And I think with a six alert system that has focused a lot on how do you reach someone, what do you tell them? Do you tell them where to find authorized files? What other... if their wireless is not secured, how might they do that to avoid someone else using their network without their permission? This is really a program that we think will affect the vast majority of people out there, but it is not going to address the needs of large-scale pirates or our need or the content community's need to deal with the problem of large-scale pirates. So, you have to take a gamble. If you think that 90% of people out there either don't understand copyright, they don't understand what the rules and obligations are, they don't understand its value, and this is an opportunity to educate them and to make available to them in a more direct way the compelling options that are available to get digital content legally and in an authorized way, hopefully we see a pretty big decrease in the use of peer-to-peer networks by people generally. But, yes, there are ways around this. There are other ways to pirate, and that is going to, for now, is not addressed by this program.
Let me ask Lincoln Fernando a question. The law does not require you folks to sign up for this process. We have the DMCA enacted 14 or so years ago that you've argued in the past is sufficient. So why do this now? Is it that you're pushing people towards legitimate services, some of which you could profit from? Is it because you don't want to deal with this unstructured approach of receiving complaints? What's the real reason?
Come on.
So, I mean, sure. I think it's important as an educational matter. I think it's an appropriate moment in the development of the Internet to actually work in a collaborative fashion with the different stakeholders. I mean, it is otherwise an environment of friction, as you describe. It's otherwise an environment of increasing legal back and forth. This is an opportunity to make it a collaborative process that puts customer education first, which for us is a win, rather than going down a path that is confrontational with customers. This is an opportunity to work collaboratively with the other ISPs and with partners in the content side and with consumer groups as well to do something that we think is the right time for it and it's the right moderated and educational approach. Do you have a...
There was, as mentioned earlier, Declan, there have been programs and we've been involved with them already with some companies doing notice and pass-throughs. Been calling it before this. And the advantage of something like this is, number one, it will be understandable by all consumers, we hope, better and educate them better because all the companies are pretty much doing the same type of thing.
Broader
not exact, not exactly the same way, but basically the framework is the same. So they will understand it better from that standpoint, less confusion. And second, it continues to have protecting privacy as a central feature. It does nothing at all in terms of providing any information to the content players about who the customer is or anything like that. The only time the customer would ever be noticed at all is if they decide they want to appeal this, and that's on their own volition if they decide to. But basically, this program still does that. And third, it has a pretty strong, I think, way to give them a chance to say, this is not, you know, not something I did. So to us, it built in protections, too, that we had not been able to do. I don't think we couldn't have done as well as an industry-wide basis as we did in this agreement.
Let's turn this over to the audience for questions. We've got about 15 minutes. We've got some microphones. If you want to, I presume we should be using the microphones.
Could somebody go first?
You've been sitting there. You know you want to get up and shout at these folks on the panel. Identify yourself unless you have an objection to anonymity or violating it.
Okay. I'm Dave Burstein. I write about some of this stuff. I'm on the board of directors of the local ISOC. I've been following the ITU. I'm on the ITAC at State Department. And I've been writing about this stuff since 99. I can't believe what I'm hearing. Well, I can believe it, but it just seems totally absurd to me. I'm a phone error. That means that I share my Wi-Fi with any other phonera in my neighborhood who happens to come by. In return for that, when I go to Paris in 2 weeks, I'll be able to hook up to about 400,000 Wi-Fi hotspots of people who do the same there. Now, this is crucial that we don't touch and affect it, because as Link knows better than I, he's a trained engineer, we need more wireless capacity. And we effectively double wireless capacity by bringing in local Wi-Fi.
So your question is?
The question is, I'm going to be there with an open Wi-Fi to anybody who passes by and anybody in my neighborhood. I sure as hell am not responsible for what they send to you. I believe there is no court judgment that's gone against that, and I believe it would be terrible public policy to shut down Wi-Fi and make us pay more to Verizon for my wireless phone. They're $70 to begin with already. So the question is, what happens if I, a Time Warner customer, gets a notice and I say my Wi-Fi is open, I don't track what people do, I couldn't possibly track what people do, How do you proceed to ignore that?
How many strikes until they're out? Sorry, Joe.
No. You're going to put me out because my Wi-Fi is open?
What's the question?
So the open Wi-Fi question, let's assume that you have people who are actually not just allegedly infringing copyrights, but actually infringing copyrights on occasion using his open Wi-Fi. Then what?
Is a question to me? Who's the question to, Dave?
Well, I happen to be one of your customers.
Well, thank you for your business.
And I've written several times that my Time Warner cable modem is rock solid, close to 10 megabits.
Thank you for your business, first of all. I believe that it's inconsistent with our terms of service for you to provide open service, you know, come as you are service on a non-commercial
what?
Basis.
That was 12 years ago. I don't know.
No, everybody's been doing this. We've got millions out there. It's been long supported, and it's obvious public policy as Link, and well, you're in the policy realm as well. You know how crucial it is to get more effective spectrum and capacity.
Actually, I hate to say it, but a lot of companies do restrict that in their terms of service.
Yeah, but I got two choices. They happen to both be up there, and they both happen to have the same terms of service, more likely than not.
Let
so
me
we
just close before we debate it, because we're not
going to
get the document in front of us.
Talks to each other.
That, and the other point is, Dave, that you'll get notices
sufficient
to educate you about whether or not that's happening on your account. And if that happens six times, and you go through the process, and what you're doing is hosting someone's ability to actually download infringing files, you will consider yourself sufficiently educated, I guess.
Are you going to shut me down for having open Wi-Fi?
It's not a
open
termination
Wi-Fi
program.
Not available?
So this is not a termination program.
So then what happens? So does it get throttled, or does the folks on the other side of the table come with a lawsuit?
At the end of that last notice,
let's assume it's like 10 notices. We're past 6.
6 is all we're going to do. And at the end of that process, basically that's it. Nothing else happens from our standpoint.
So then it's up to
that's our obligation under the program.
It's up to the other end of the table then.
Then so this goes back to my point earlier, which is this program, you know, with all due respect, is not going to change your behavior at all or address your approach to this. And you know, if 80% of the people that we're dealing with as primary account holders are like that, then, you know, we'll probably have to reconsider. But I would say this, which is once you have gotten five or six notices, depending on the ISP, and you have gone through a mitigation measure. So you will, depending on who your ISP is, you might have your internet slowed down for a couple days, and you can be pissed at Verizon, you can be pissed at the people using your network to violate copyright. And then you won't get any more notices, and nothing will happen under this program. However, you're not going to be shut down. You actually won't ever get another notice. You will be sort of unreachable by the program. But I will say, to represent all of the ISPs that are in the program, for all of them, it is, in fact, against their terms of service, not necessarily to have an open wireless, but to allow someone to use your wireless for copyright infringement. And so whatever your terms of service is, I think if you read it, you are responsible as the primary account holder for that activity. That doesn't require you to shut down your wireless, but you're on notice.
Let's take another question. If you could identify yourself.
Well, number one, it doesn't
sound... You are.
Oh, I'm sorry. My name is Timothy Sanders. I don't know of any reliable technical means to contact users over the internet connection unless you're using deep packet inspection or you can intercept SSL to modify. I'm assuming you're using a transparent proxy to make a pop-up, as you called it, but there's no reliable way to do that, as I'm sure anybody here knows, especially as if somebody's using Google, it's going to be SSL the entire way. So how do you address that? And also, the content industry really does need to be educated. Still, they have a long history of failure from the DMCA, which has been thoroughly abused. And as a content creator myself, my competitors have used it to prevent me from distributing content. So what assurances can you give based on every time we've had a similar thing like this, it's been abused, that it will not continue to happen?
Let's actually, we're kind of running low on time, so let's take the other questions in quick succession and then let the panelists respond, if you don't mind. Yes, sir.
Hi, my name is Joe Plotkin. I'm on the board of ISOC New York as well as on the board of NYC Wireless. We do free Wi-Fi around New York in public places so that people can, do whatever they want to do in public places on the internet. It seems absurd to me, no different than, preventing me from, if I owned a store and I had a payphone in my store and somebody planned a bank robbery on my payphone, am I supposed to be policing what people are saying on the payphone in my store? It seems analogous to the situation of forcing everybody to lock down their Wi-Fi on behalf of, to act as agents of the copyright holders. It seems a little, to use a old New York expression, a little chutzpahdick.
Another New York expression, I hope.
My name is Paul Geller. I'm personally being sued for $17 billion by members of the RIAA. And I just heard three instances where we were applauding compromise. I was just wondering if we thought it was important or even proper to be applauding compromise on something as important as freedom of speech. It seems more like that'd be something that we should be fighting for. My question, though, is more about what happens in the instance that we do detect that there are sort of fraudulent notices being sent, either fraudulent or even mistake notices. Is there some recourse, not from the user's end, but is there going to be a penalization of companies or copyright industry sort of companies for either abusing the system or accidentally sending takedown notices, so to speak, to use a sort of DMCA term?
I have some questions from the internet, but let's... have some responses to the last three from the panel, if there are any quick responses.
I'm happy to take the last question. We did have a technical review of the content methodology done by Strauss Friedberg. A public version or redacted version of that report is available on the CCI website. That was the initial view to try to determine that the content owners are not fraudulently sending notices. There will also be periodic subsequent reviews of the methodology. So we're trying to address that concern through these periodic reviews.
My only follow-up would be, why isn't it working in the DMCA then? why are we still getting fraudulent takedown notices or notices that don't apply to fair use? Why can't the system identify that stuff yet?
Well, let me try to amplify your question and say, under the DMCA, if you have to send a takedown notice assigned under penalty of perjury, so there's some legal consequences in theory. EFF has been trying to litigate this area. If you make a mistake. But are there any assigned under penalty of perjury or similar steps? Put up a bond if you're a copyright holder, requirements in this process.
Under the MOU, any notice that we send is also under penalty of perjury.
Let's go to the internet for some questions.
You didn't answer some of the-
Sorry. Hold on. Let's let the folks around. Give me just 2 minutes. So questions from the internet. Why were the smaller internet providers not invited to participate in this system? A quick response. Anyone? Maybe Jill.
I would turn it around to say this was kind of a groundbreaking effort that took a lot of time to. Come to fruition, and I think we have been discussing actually adding additional participants as soon as we get the program up and running. So it's not intended to be exclusive by any means, but these were the people around the table initially.
I should add on the other side, on the content owner side.
That was my next question. Were other content owners invited to join?
Well, they are, and it may be a slightly misleading to have representatives from two trade associations and Fox here. Under the umbrella of the MPA and the RIA, are many, many smaller independent content owners. Through the IFTA, which is the Independent Film and Television Alliance, which represents independent motion picture producers, and A2IM, which represents smaller independent record labels, are participating via the RIAA.
Here's one more. I'll just take one more question from the internet. And under the MOU, the participating ISPs are obliged to collect and share information on repeated infringers. This information could potentially be used to sue individual subscribers. Why is this language in the agreement?
That's actually not accurate, because the identity of individuals is not provided to the content owners. So what we learned through the system would not help us to sue anybody if we wanted to do that.
Let's take another question from the audience.
Did I hear correctly that this was only looking at P2P networks?
Right. That's right. It's it's residential wireline P2P, so it's quite narrow.
So as far as like file lockers or personal...
Not part of this program.
Okay. I wanted to make space.
So let me... do we have any other questions from the audience? Yes, sir.
I'm Jeff Jarvis. I'll be speaking to the panel, so I want to pick up.
Just one question.
I don't...
Microphone.
Switch on the...
There's a mic on your desk.
Thank you. It floods. You go through the six strikes, and then suddenly there's peace in the kingdom. I'm not buying that. So just say this. If someone goes and does it again and again and again and again and again, what do any of you do? You haven't really answered that. That's really what I...
Well, I think the ISPs said, hey, well, our work here is done. So how about the other side?
It's the same as today, before the... program goes into effect, what are we going to do about piracy? I mean, right? It's a six notice system, and it's done. We're done with the notice system. We have the same legal remedies that we have today, or which we make use of or not. We can sue end users. We can, do education campaigns. We can do...
What are you obligated to use this before you sue anyway?
No.
No. And two, is this discoverable in a suit? The fact that I ignored six notices.
I think that's probably the point of the six notices.
That's what I'm saying.
But
it's
let's.
Not so
so would. Let's. Any responses?
I'm not sure what the legal significance of that is, but I don't know. Maybe some copyright.
We've got some lawyers on the panel.
No, I play one on TV.
I mean, it's been, 4 or 5 years since either the major record labels or the major movie studios have been suing individual peer-to-peer users. I'm not aware of any plans by any one of us to start doing that. Will we ever say we're never going to do that again?
I don't think anyone's willing to say that.
But it's certainly not part of the system, and it's certainly not something that's on the table.
The system is designed to make that less appealing, frankly. That, from our perspective, the whole idea is it becomes less important to think about suing people because of the existence of the system. We'll have to see if it works or in that regard or not, but that's our hope.
any recompense if internet users are falsely accused? But I guess the answer would be that there's no real harm except a brief slowdown. So there shouldn't be.
Which they don't even have to suffer that.
Right. As soon as you file the so-called appeal, the imposition of the mitigation measure is stayed. So if you've basically gone through and gotten the first four alerts, and you're still allegedly infringing, and you get the fifth, and you say, no, that's actually inaccurate, I really didn't do it, and you decide to file an appeal, as soon as you file the appeal, the imposition of that mitigation measure is stayed. So you basically will never suffer it if you prevail in your appeal. In other words, demonstrate that the copyright alert was not accurate.
And you reset to zero also if you win your appeal.
Well, there's throw out this. Anna Marie Bridey from the University of Idaho came out with an analysis. She said some good things about the system. She said some more negative things. She said there's insufficient safeguards to ensure the accuracy of allegations. She said there's no way for the public to know whether the program is meeting the goals established for it in the MOU. How about a response to that? How are we going to know whether this thing works or not?
It's funny because I actually just happened to have read her article over lunch before I came over here today. The focus of her complaints is really about transparency. I believe the article came out several months ago. Since then, a number of the things that she was complaining about have been publicly announced as part of the run-up to the launch of the program. For example, release of the technical analysis, the release of the identity of the fair use expert whose memorandum is going to inform the reviewers who administer the appeals process. So, I mean, even I think that most of the things that she was actually complaining about in her article have since been mitigated.
Well, so we'll see on the next panel whether the public interest groups agree. Do we have any other questions from the audience? I see a hand up. There's a microphone control somewhere on your desk.
You can do it on the desk there, yes.
And so you are?
I'm Kevin Collier.
Can you hear? Yeah, no, I can hear you, Kevin.
The Daily Dot. Can you describe what the appeals process will look like? Who's running the appeals process? Is there transparency with that?
Sure. So the appeals process is going to be run by the American Arbitration Association. They are, as I think most people know, sort of the foremost expert in the country with most experience around alternative dispute resolution. They have worked with us over the past year to build an interface so that this system will be pretty much all seamless for the consumer. They can link directly from their ISP to say, I want to file an appeal. They sign into the AAA, create a username and password. In fact, they don't even have to use their real name at that point. Can file an appeal for several of the reasons, because there are a set of reasons that people can appeal. It's a misidentification of file. This wasn't me, fair use. For several of the categories, they never have to identify themselves. And actually, when they pay $35 and it's processed by a third-party payment processor, that information is never combined. So even the people at AAA won't necessarily know who the consumer is. There is an exception. So if a user says, I had authorization to use that file, one of the things the user has to do is present that authorization. And one would think that would be personal authorization. So I, Jill Lesser, was given the right by Warner Brothers to share this movie, and here's evidence of that. That process is laid out in the MOU how many days they have to review the packet of information that comes both from the ISP and the content owner on how the file, the methodology, how the file was found, the date and time, making sure matching up the date and time with the use of a particular IP address, and how the ISP matched the consumer. They will then, after looking at that appeal, issue a decision. If the appeal is probably the wrong word, but if the notices or the alert is invalidated, then the consumer will be, number one, refunded his or her $35, and number two, their account will be reset to zero. So if you were at level four in an ISP that gets to mitigation at level four, you'll end up back at zero.
Are we getting the hook, Paul?
We are.
Time is up.
Yeah,
there's Well, our next panel has Jeff Jarvis as our moderator. But there's no requirement that these folks showed up today. Sometimes the decisions like this get made entirely behind closed doors. And so I'm very grateful that they did. And also to the Internet Society, and I suspect Paul did a lot of the organization for this. Let's give everyone, especially the Internet Society, a round of applause.
And thank you, Declan. That was just outstanding. So the other panel, our next panel, please come on up, and we will make a quick transition.
Should we pull our own name tags?
Yes. Name tags?
You can leave them on, I'm sorry.
Oh, leave them up?
Yeah. We're actually going to put something on top.
Oh, got it. Sorry about that.
That's all right.
I was in LA when that happened.
Water down there. So I'm Jeff Jarvis. I'm going to blame bad moderation on Sandy. I'm going to blame everything on Sandy for the next few weeks. So I want to start. I think that the views of this group are not probably so obvious as the name tags of the last group. So what I would like to do in this session is just ask each of them to spend a couple of minutes briefly saying their view of this. So you all have context. We'll have a little discussion up here, and the more we have discussion with everyone in the room of the whole, the panel of the whole, then the better. So, Gigi, you want to start?
Sure. Good afternoon, everybody. I'm Gigi Sohn. I'm the president and CEO of Public Knowledge. We're a public interest advocacy organization that fights for an open internet and balanced copyright laws. I'm very glad I had a glass of wine at lunch. So I'm on the advisory board of the Center for Copyright Information. And I want to talk a little bit about what my role is and a little bit about what I think of the program. Obviously, if I thought it was the devil's spawn, I would not be on the advisory board. I actually think that the system has some value if done right, and that's why I'm on the advisory board. I need to pick up on something that Ron Wheeler said. These kind of notices have been going on for about 5-6 years now. This really is nothing new. Now, why there's a big MOU and an appeals process and all that, you need to ask the content industry, because that's kind of the way they wanted it. But now I think we actually have a system that has more due process and more openness and more transparency. Not as much as I want, believe you me, and I can talk a little bit about some of my concerns with the program that I'd like to see rectified at some point. But I think in a lot of ways this is a better system than the one that there was before. That doesn't mean it's perfect by any means. But I want to talk a little bit about my role, because it was not an easy decision, as Jill and the other folks who work with the CCI will tell you, in the post-SOPA PIPA era, which my organization was, one of the leading folks fighting those bills, to do something like this. But the reason I wanted to do it was because I thought there was a role for a real consumer advocate to make sure that consumers were protected, that this system is fairly implemented with a minimum of false positives, due process, and a great deal of transparency and openness. And what I've been spending, I guess, the last 6 months or so is really beating the living daylights, and Jill Lesser will tell you this, and she and I have been friends for about 20 years. I've been beating living daylights out of her and her colleagues to be more transparent and open. I'm not going to give myself entire credit for the Stroh's report being a release, but I beat up on them on that. When the time comes when there's enough data collected about how many people get notices and how many sort of repeat offenders there are and how many appeals and how many appeals are successful. I'm going to want to see that released to the public as well and that data open so people could do studies on it. And we talked about the Stroh's report. There's a huge elephant in the room. If anybody reads the Daily Dot or who's the other, Ernesto from Torn Freak, released the fact that, you know, 4 years ago, Stroh's Friedberg did some lobbying for the Recording Industry Association of America. I'm not going to pass judgment on whether that made them, you know, not qualified or not to do this report, but the CCI has pledged to have another independent analyst analyze the report and analyze the methodology. And if people have ideas, you know, rather than complain, if people have ideas for a really good analyst to take this on, I gave a speech at Princeton last week and talked to Ed Felton and Steve Scholes. I think they would be excellent folks. But if there's anybody else, if people have ideas, come and tell me. I really see myself as sort of a liaison to the consumer community and being a real pain in the behind, not only to the content industry, but also to the ISPs as well. I just want to say very, very briefly, you know, if I could wave a magic wand of the things I'd like to see changed in the MOU, I'll just say what they are briefly. And then I want to make two other points, and then I'll stop. I mean, I was not crazy about the appeal fee. It was originally $50. We got it down to $35. It does get waived in a number of instances. If you show hardship, I think that's good. Not perfect, but better. I don't like the fact that you can only use the open wireless excuse. To Dave Burstein's point, he's left only once. There were very good reasons to have open wireless, and I think, you know, the telecom industry and the cable industry thinks open wireless is pretty damn good too. I wanted the copyright owners to show more proof that they actually own the copyright. I don't think they have to show enough proof. And I also thought that in the appeals process, an individual should have all copyright defenses. Now, they have quite a few, but I think you should have all. If it's not illegal under copyright law, you know, you should be able to defend yourself under anything. It shouldn't be limited. Let me make two closing points. While I do think that this system has some educational value, and I do think if it's done right, it will be largely benign, there's another half of the equation that I'm going to continue to talk about in my role of public knowledge, and that is the need for the content industry to make their content available ubiquitously and at a fair price. I listened to NPR today, and there was a lot of talk how the movie studios are starting to make their movies available even before the theater release date. I think that's fabulous, except they're only doing it on video on demand. I'd like to see them make it available online. It's not just about consumers doing the right thing, and the ISPs doing the right thing. I think the content companies have to start to do the right thing too, and I'm glad that they're starting. The second point I want to make is that I see a lot of energy in this room and a lot of folks upset, and I can understand it. I get it, right? I mean, I've been doing this kind of work for 11 years now. But I'd like to see a lot of that negative energy put towards positive copyright reform. Somebody talked about fraudulent notices and what's the penalty. For example, under the DMCA, when somebody willy-nilly sends a bunch of fraudulent notices, well, my organization has a proposal that would punish those abusers. So am I going to get 14 million people to weigh in on Congress for something positive like people did negatively against SOAP and PIPA? Think about that. I think we actually have an opportunity to make affirmative change and strengthen fair use and strengthen consumer rights. In this Congress, we have some very powerful people who want to be on our side, including Daryl Issa and Chuck Schumer and people like that. So think about whether you can turn the negative energy into something positive. And if you can, sign up for our mailing list.
Hi, so my name is Molly Land. I'm a professor here. And I just wanted to thank, before we got started, I just wanted to thank the Internet Society and Paul for hosting this here. It's great to have you and for the invitation. So my background is in international law and specifically human rights law. And I know that Constantine already started out talking about Frank LaRue's statement. But I want to follow up on that and really focus on some of the human rights concerns that have been raised around the scheme. So there's a number of different types of concerns you might see. There's privacy concerns. I know the first panel talked about how A lot of this kind of monitoring has already gone on, but there have also been questions raised about deep packet inspection and additional surveillance and monitoring that's going to be necessary to track user behavior, and that raises privacy concerns. Another concern might be the cost of the program, which has been, there have been various ranges estimated for the cost that ISPs are going to incur for funding this, and those costs being passed on to consumers, which has an effect on ability of access, right? That it might, in some cases, become an additional burden on people who are already economically disadvantaged. And I guess the one I wanted to really focus more on is the question of the sanction, because that's received the most attention under international law, at least, specifically the possibility that access might be terminated, that internet access might be terminated to users, even temporarily. So this has raised a lot of concerns because it affects certainly rights of expression, the ability to exchange information, and freedom of association, right? Because this is how we socialize, this is how we connect with our friends, our family, and loved ones. The concern that's been raised under international human rights law is that the sanction of termination is disproportionate to the goals of the system, particularly because the internet plays such a crucial role in all aspects of our lives. Now, I was encouraged in the first panel that I think it was the statement was this is not a termination program, and that if there were six notices sent out, that at the end that was sort of it, and people weren't going to be cut off. But I don't want to leave the issue there. I'd actually be really interested in hearing more about, is this a decision of all ISPs? Is this only the decision of these particular providers? If there has been a decision not to have termination be on the table, can we get that in writing? because it's in the memorandum of understanding. Mitigation measures can include temporary redirection to a landing page, temporary restriction, temporary redirection until you complete an educational program, or such other temporary mitigation measures may be applied by the participating ISP. So the possibility is still there. And given the importance of the internet, I want to really encourage us to think very strongly about the consequences of termination for our rights. I want to leave more time for discussion, so I'll jump to just a few closing thoughts about proposals to go forward. I think the human rights concerns that are on the table don't mean that you can't construct a copyright system of this kind. I think I share your concern that I want to try to make it better. And so I leave just a few closing thoughts. One would be, again, given the problems associated with termination, right? And just to give context to that, I was thinking today about everything I use the internet for. To buy groceries, to buy diapers, to find health information about, you know, how to treat my sick children. It's really so central that I just feel that termination is something that we need to focus on. So we might consider taking it off the table. I think if we take that off the table, it helps in a number of ways. First of all, less severe sanctions are going to be more proportional and therefore more valid under human rights law and you know, just in terms of social justice perspectives in general. I think it also helps alleviate some concerns with due process, right? There's concerns about the process that's been constructed, and if the sanction is less severe, then the process may not be more satisfied with a more abbreviated process or more presumptions such as are currently in the process. And then I think the last thing I would encourage us to do is think about the accuracy, and not the technical accuracy, which I think we've already talked about, but the legal accuracy of the process that's provided. I'm concerned about the fact that the presumption has been shifted, that the burden is on the user to show that they're entitled, that they're not, in fact, an infringer. I'm concerned about that both because our approach in general is, right, you know, you're innocent until proven guilty, or so that we want to not put that burden on people. But in particular, because if a person is subject to a mitigation measure or a sanction, and they don't have, I know $35, it's better than 50, but it's still 35, and it could be waived, that's true, but it's a process you have to initiate, and for people who don't have a lot of time, don't have a lot of resources, don't have a lot of wherewithal, it can be a significant burden to even have to go through that process itself to initiate it. So imposing a burden of process on someone to show that they are in fact entitled to continue having their access, I think, is problematic. And then there's some other legal parts of the scheme that are concerning presumptions of accuracy that apply. So if we are worried about technical accuracy, we have to understand that that works in conjunction with the legal provisions that exist in the Memorandum of Understanding.
Thank you. I want to notice that I'm seeing some beast I haven't seen in a long while, the fail whale. Are you, is Twitter down? So I don't know how we want to get questions from or comments later. If there's another method, let me know.
Are we closing the fail whale, or is it something else about General Petraeus?
It's the Super Bowl of internet rights. I'm Aronson Wright. I'm a professor of media studies at Rutgers University. I just got done writing a book called The Piracy Crusade, which is available freely under Creative Commons license in draft form online at piracycrusade.com. A lot of my concerns have already been addressed by my fellow panelists and by a lot of you in the audience during the first panel, but I would point out a few issues. Number one, there is a significant civil liberties issue here. Thank you. Now, that civil liberties issue comes in many forms. There's the freedom of speech issue, which is just this year, the UN has ratified internet access as a fundamental human right, and the notion that it's a good thing that this policy doesn't kick people off the internet entirely, but even the notion of redirecting you to a splash page where you have to address the grievances of the content industry before you can have access to basic internet services is very problematic. Also, we've talked a lot about the many ways in which over the last 15 years the DMCA has been misapplied. This is an oldie, but it's still a goodie in the respect that, if you look at the most recent presidential campaign, for instance, you saw, the exemplars of free speech and of fair use political campaigns being taken off of YouTube fraudulently with DMCA takedown notices. That's one of many, many, many examples of how these kinds of policies all too often tend to err on the side of overprotection. And, the metaphor that I always use when I'm talking to lay people is you get, dolphins caught in the tuna nets. And the question isn't really, are dolphins going to die or do people have a right to fish for tuna? The question is really, where do you draw the line? How many dolphin deaths are you willing to accept in order to maintain the tuna industry? And, for all the wonkiness of these conversations, that's really the fundamental question that debates over this kind of policy come down to. Now, in addition to the civil liberties issues, like free speech, there's also civil rights issues. So part of the research that I do in the academy is these massive surveys, looking at the way that people all over the world use new technologies to engage in emerging cultural forms, like mashups and remixes and video game mods and machinima and all this wonderful stuff that I call configurable culture. And when I've done these surveys, I find something very interesting about people's use of privacy tools on the internet. Now, if you look across all different age groups, from the youngest people I surveyed, which is 18, to the oldest, which is 90-something, every single age group is equally concerned with their privacy on the internet. In fact, it ends up being on a 5-point scale, about a 4.0 across the board. But what you find is that the older that respondents get, the less likely they are to have actually adjusted their privacy settings. And that really scales linearly with age, because it scales with internet expertise. You also find the same kind of dynamic applying to things like education and income. So the wealthier you are, the younger you are, the better educated you are, the more likely you are to have actually done something about your privacy online, regardless of how much you care about it. That is a serious issue when you think about the fact that this is essentially a tuna net that only catches the poorest and most disenfranchised tuna in the ocean. Right? As was pointed out by one of the audience members during the first panel, people who are internet savvy, people who have good educations, people who are young, people who are already socially enfranchised are going to be the ones who know well enough to use a VPN or to use Tor or to use some other tool that's going to elude the grasp of the content monitors, which means that the people who end up getting caught and having their lives interrupted by this, having to pay the fees, having to consult their lawyers, having to face the prospect of being disenfranchised in terms of losing their internet access, even to some degree for a period of time, are going to be the most disenfranchised groups in our society. So this is going to widen the gap between the information haves and the information have-nots. The last point that I would make, because like everyone else here, I could go on about this for hours, but the last point I would make, and I don't think anyone's really pointed this out yet, and I apologize, because I actually do think this is a very good faith effort on behalf of industry. You know, in the spectrum of anti-piracy measures, laws and policies that have been enacted over the years, this is very, very mild and very, very fair to the needs of consumers. That being said, this is not going to work. I don't mean from a technical standpoint, although that's debatable. I'd have to know more about the platform. But it's not going to work in terms of the social aspect. And this is, I've traced, long before I was in academia, I was a research analyst for a firm here in New York City called Jupiter Research. And I published what I think is the first research ever published back in about 12, 13 years ago on the effect of file sharing on music sales. And I was the guy that said Napster was actually helping sell music back in spring of 2000 or something, for which I was crucified by my own clients at the RIAA and the MPAA. And what I was telling people at the time when the Napster decision was happening and Judge Patel said there had to be 100% accuracy in Napster's content matching, otherwise the service couldn't operate, I said at the time, this is a hydra, and if you cut off one of the heads, more heads will spring up, and all you're going to do is end up fragmenting the so-called piracy base and end up sending it deeper and deeper underground. And exactly the same thing is true here, right? Piracy requires a network effect in order to work. Peer-to-peer is something that five people can do well, 50 people can do astoundingly well, and 50 million people can turn into a vibrant platform. And by aiming at the level of people who don't have the capacity to use a workaround like Tor or a VPN, excuse me, I'm a little parched, what you're essentially doing is assuring that the people who are most equipped to develop the next generation of peer-to-peer tools are going to be the ones who have an incentive to do exactly that. So I think if this does anything, it's going to make the unlicensed use of content over the internet more of a problem rather than less for the content industry. And I also think it's a bad bargain. Thank you. I actually have one in front of me, but I actually think it's a bad bargain for the ISPs. You know, my intuition. Sorry, I've been on speaking tour for the last 3 weeks. My intuition is that the ISP's incentive in getting into this is they want to preserve DMCA safe harbors, and they don't want to see legislation come down in the U.S. that's going to impose a three strikes law that, like we've seen in France, although that might be turned over, in England and elsewhere. And I don't think that Hollywood is going to be happy enough with the way that this works to stop with this policy. To the contrary, I think what it's going to do is it's actually going to raise the bar a little bit, right? So the anti-piracy crusaders are going to be able to say, well, even the ISPs agree that this level of content monitoring is necessary, and therefore why don't we instantiate it in some kind of legislation? And this is a process that you see over and over and over again with anti-piracy policies around the world, is let's gain an inch over here, and then we'll gain another inch over there and another inch over here, and by the end of the process, you've gone a whole mile. So to me, this isn't an inch gained by the ISPs in order to forestall a mile lost. It's an inch that's been lost on the way to that mile marker. And again, I could keep talking great length, but I'll pass it
over to David.
Thanks. So first, I've been having some technical difficulty with my voice this week, so hopefully it won't sound too scratchy. My name is David Sohn. I'm with the Center for Democracy and Technology, which is a nonprofit public interest group in Washington. I should probably say no relation to GG, despite the shared last name. My overall view on this is that I'm actually hopeful that it has the potential to play a positive role. I think there are also some real risks and some implementation questions. My overall impression is that the program is off to a pretty good start in trying to anticipate and head off some of the potential problems. But I think ultimately we're going to have to wait and see how it all plays out in practice, and it is going to bear watching very closely to make sure that it doesn't go off the rails. So I'll say a little bit about why I see some positive potential and then talk about some of the implementation questions and risks that I see. In terms of the positive potential, I do think there's a shared interest in trying to find some ways to reduce copyright infringement that don't carry major collateral damage. And we've seen legislation in Washington. We've seen a lot of other copyright initiatives that do threaten very serious collateral damage. I think this is one that, if it's done right, could avoid things like interfering with the internet's technical architecture, interfering with the ability of ISPs or other kind of social networking tools to empower users with new communications capabilities, and hopefully not push ISPs to take on new privacy invasive practices like snooping on users or trying to control user behavior. This goes a little bit to the question that Aram was just mentioning about, is this going to be an alternative to something else, or is it just going to be the first step on a slippery slope? But certainly on its own terms, I think what this agreement asks ISPs to do is not nearly as burdensome or problematic as some of the other proposals that we've seen. The key going forward, I think, is going to be to really maintain the educational focus that you heard people talking about on that first panel. I mean, the long-term challenge for addressing copyright infringement has to be to get users to have attitude and behavior changes that lead to less infringement. Because the alternative, I mean, the technology to engage in infringement is here to stay. You're not going to be able to take away people's communications tools or access to the internet and to digital technologies. So the level of infringement is really going to depend on what users choose to do. And so I think education really is part of a long-range constructive solution to the problem of infringement. We need to try to get to the point, not where nobody infringes, because there's always going to be some, but ideally we get to a point where most of the people, most of the time, don't bother to engage in infringement, don't see that as the choice that they would want to make because, among other things, there's decent lawful services, and perhaps because they're getting notices that keep them informed. So to the risks and the questions. If the focus were to evolve away from pure education and towards punishment, I think that raises the serious questions that other people have discussed about due process and is it really appropriate to punish people based on a private determination like this without any involvement of a court? Absolutely. CDT was very concerned when the MOU was first released because it did seem to envision internet suspension among the possible mitigation measures. I think we've heard pretty clear statements that it's not currently in any ISP's plan to do that, so we're certainly encouraged by that.
Although it's open to that possibility.
So it certainly is there in the agreement. So this is why I say there are implementation questions to watch as this thing evolves, right? If people were to implement it in that way, I would be deeply, deeply concerned about that. If nobody implements it in that way, then we've got a different analysis. The worst case scenario has not come to pass, right? There are some additional questions, which I'll try to tick through quickly. One, I think, was raised by a questioner to the first panel that wasn't really answered, which was, is it really that easy to give people notices that they pay attention to and actually see? It's a non-trivial problem. How do you actually give a notice? I mean, if a pop-up shows up on the computer screen, well, if the fundamental problem is that there's a 15-year-old in the household who's engaging in file sharing and the parents have no idea, the pop-up may reach the same 15-year-old and just be clicked through. So, you know, it's I think, a tricky problem to see how good a job will this do of reaching the actual account holders who have some ability to control it. Second, there's the question of how effective the system will be in avoiding erroneous flags of infringing content. It is my understanding that the system is being set up to try to only catch instances of whole works or nearly whole works that are infringing, so that you know, your kind of fair use situations where a documentary or some other file has an excerpt from a copyrighted work would not get flagged. That's my understanding. I don't know how well in practice the system will do at avoiding fair use kind of situations. So I think that we'll just have to see how that plays out. And then to the extent that some mistakes like that, or like just identifying the wrong account, to the extent that that occurs, how effective will the system's safeguards be in addressing that? There is an appeals process. Will it really be simple and practical enough for people who need to take advantage of it to take advantage of it? And then additionally, this goes a little bit to the transparency issue Gigi raised, although it's a little broader than that too. I'm curious to what extent the system will be able to track whatever mistakes get made and learn from them, so that if there are problems in how this works, if people are being wrongly flagged, how does that get fed into the system? Is there any kind of feedback loop where that gets noticed and rectified over time and any flaws get exposed? If people are bringing successful appeals, for example, that suggests that the system was making some mistakes on the front end, and in addition to dismissing that person's particular notices, it seems like at that point there ought to be some process for trying to make sure that whatever mistakes caused the mistaken notices in the first place get fixed on a going forward basis. You could even imagine a situation where a documentary film keeps getting identified wrongly as being infringing because it contains some clip of copyrighted content on a fair use basis. Ideally, you'd want the system to take that kind of file, make a hash of that, and have some reference database of files that it's going to stop flagging in the future so that it's not sending mistaken notices. All that's entirely possible. Maybe all of that will happen. It's just these are implementation questions, and I just don't know how they will play out. Let me mention one final thing real quick, which is just that I think has not come up. Consistent with that whole educational purpose, I think it is envisioned that the Copyright Information Center is going to be providing information about copyright to people. I think it will be really important going forward that be, to sort of use the Fox News slogan, fair and balanced information. There are some really hotly disputed issues of copyright law right now. And if that information were to be slanted towards one particular viewpoint, or were to be kind of the equivalent of what you see in sports broadcasts, where they say any description of this content can get you in trouble, clearly overstating what the legal situation is, the whole organization would really, I think, lose its ability to be a credible source of education if it took a one-sided view of these issues.
Thanks. I'm going to just go add take the prerogative of supposed to be an opinionated moderator, so I'll add one note here, and then I think we go straight to discussion with the whole room, because I think time is getting nigh. What I hear here at low level is we have a trust problem, right? We have a trust problem of the industry trusting its users. We have certainly a problem of the users trusting these industries. And so this comes along and looks like a benign program, but people like me are asking, well, yeah, come on, what's really going on here? At a very high level, we have a human rights question. The internet is so vital to society now that there is a reaction to saying that even slowing it down or trying to threaten our use of it in any way is an issue now of human rights. And I think that's an important angle on this. And I would argue that if you have a case like, fine, you're not cutting it off, but you're cutting it down, didn't we learn from Mubarak that the internet is a human right? One more point. I distrust a business model that relies on telling users, customers, they cannot do what they want to do, and then trying to make technology do what it can't do. There's not a lot of future in that, and I think we still haven't grappled with that, so we're still going around the issue of copyright. I'm not against copyright. I will happily sell you my latest book called Public Parts. But I do think that we haven't figured out the new models of how to think about this, and I want to mention just one very quickly. There's something called repost.us that turns an article into an embeddable unit that travels wherever it's embedded with brand advertising, revenue, analytics, and links. So we have the one case of now news publishers around the world going after Google like crazy saying, you're robbing from us. And why not go with the flow and say, well, what if we enabled our content babies to fly on their own and bring value back to us? Then we would change the model. And I think there's too little discussion of trying to understand the reality of the internet and the reality of the new models and the reality of what was called by one of the people in the previous panel a new social norm. If that really is a social norm, then how do we take advantage of it? How do we build an industry around it? The clever will do that. The doomed will not. With that, I'm happy to ask questions, get discussion going, but I think we have time limited, so I would love to make sure that we get everybody involved. And don't forget to hit the button and identify yourself.
Yeah, Michael Drobak from Patton Boggs. And a question I have, which is a little off scope, but I think it would be interesting to hear. I think the group's discussion here and focus on P2P networks is certainly very interesting. But when we talk about the benefits for consumers in terms of what they can do online in terms of freedom of speech and just all of the material, the information that's available. I look at the internet ecosystem, I'm also seeing that it is highly monetized by advertising, and that those sites that are providing such an incredible content to consumers are monetizing it largely through advertising, and they don't really care where that advertising is going. And so you have sites that are both providing legal content and illegal content. And so at what point do we look at something like this and say, there's actually a benefit to consumers that you're getting notifications that you may be on a site that is trafficking in both legal and illegal content, and therefore you have a choice. But there's also has to be some sort of mechanism, I think, in here to discipline the advertising networks and the ecosystem that is really forcing, that is allowing for a great deal of advertisers to share.
Which is what Google has argued, yeah? Yes. Google go after the advertising.
Google's the chief offender.
They do it, but they also argue with that method, yeah.
So we heard from content providers who are saying, look, I think we're giving notification, there's really not going to be a lot of punishment, but we want people to know. Then we've heard from consumer advocates who I think have thoughtfully said we want to work together, but we haven't really looked at the internet architecture generally, how the internet is being monetized, which is through advertising. And you have advertising networks that are essentially black boxes, where do the companies really care, the advertisers, if they're getting clicks, they're getting advertisements, and they're receiving money from this, how would we stop that?
Any reaction? I mean, this doesn't address that.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a little bit off point, right? I mean, this is just focused on peer-to-peer networks. Most of the commercial peer-to-peer networks, or a lot of them, are long gone. I mean, they've been sued out of existence.
My understanding is...
It's an interesting question, but it really doesn't get to what this does.
Yeah, this is BitTorrent only. Right, BitTorrent is an open protocol that all of the major builds of it are non-commercial in nature. Right, so I mean, there are companies that make money off of distributing BitTorrent client software, but not a ton of it. I don't think this is directly addressed by the policy.
I do want to heartily agree with something that Jeff said, and that's about the trust issue. And Jill should smile because, I mean, this has been a lot about my push about transparency and openness. There is a lack of trust, and it's a double-sided lack of trust. And that's why I think this system really has to engage the public. I mean, I will give CCI credit. Before they launched, they took the advice of the advisory board, and they went and did messaging, and I think Jill spoke about it on the first panel, and focus groups, and learn the lesson that, you know, the wagging finger is not the way to change social norms. You can't call people thieves and pirates and expect them to respect what you're asking them to do. So, I mean, there is a huge trust gap, and I think one of the things that the CCI wants to do, and this is, again, the entity that's implementing the copyright alert system, but also wants to engage in copyright education, is to try to, as much as possible, close that trust gap. I think that is job one, and you could see it from the reaction in this room.
I'll be curious to see the wording too of these notices, and the blue shirt, and then the black shirt. You can just hit your button.
Actually, he said that they're not working.
The button's not working too well, so let's go to the mic, possibly.
And for the webcast, in an ideal world, obviously, in the name of free speech and everything, I think that we would just be able to have an open system that wasn't regulated in any way, shape, or form, but also in the same way, in an ideal world, we also wouldn't have any copyright infringement and people wouldn't be stealing things from each other and whatnot. So, and Gigi, you said that you want to put kind of an emphasis on positive, you know, moving in a positive manner, not just being angry about all this stuff. And going along with that, I don't think it's completely unrealistic for some of these people to want or desire a system where people who are stealing things are accountable. But what I want to ask you guys is, what are your guys' ideas? So, you know, obviously the burden is on these people who have a lack of resources to be able to get themselves out there, while a lot of these companies have vast resources behind in their legal teams and everything to be able to enforce this, and especially in lobbying groups and everything. So in your guys' minds, what's a way that these people could be held accountable for overextending the power that they've been giving through all these processes and whatnot? And, you know, people like overflagging content and users and things like that. And how do you think a legal mechanism would work? Or it's open for all of you.
Well, there was actually a similar, there was a bill similar to the one that, that Gigi was talking about in Brazil that would have punished companies for interrupting their version of fair use with phony takedown notices from their version of DMCA. So certainly something that would counterbalance that kind of unilateral power to censor that exists within private industry right now. There's also interesting legislation that's been put forward. I think Gigi mentioned Ron Wyden before, or she mentioned Daryl Issa. So Ron Wyden and Daryl Issa have, you know, pushed legislation like the Open Act, which unfortunately wasn't passed this year. That would set forth a set of bill of rights for consumers or citizens or however you want to think of us. That would say, well, okay, we can pass these laws and we can create these policies, but they can't go past a certain threshold, right? That threshold being equal participation in the public sphere, equal access to information, all these kinds of basic civil rightsy, civil libertiesy issues that we've been addressing up here. So those two issues are key. And then the third thing that I would mention is the industry has actually had a lot of interesting ideas about how to create business models that assume a plenitude of information rather than trying to restrict information and sell it on a bit-by-bit basis. But they have self-imploded every time they've tried to instantiate these models. A great example, and I actually write about this in my book, having interviewed some of the principals, was Chorus, which came out of Warner Music Group a few years ago. It was a pet project by Edgar Bronfman, who was then the head of Warner. And what he wanted to do was to blanket license at the ISP level. And it wasn't even a license, it was a covenant not to sue for various legal reasons. But the basic idea was charge the ISPs $5 that they would pass on to their consumers. It would be virtually invisible to the end user, and nobody would ever get sued for any kind of infringement ever. Now, a lot of people had issues with that, and rightfully so. But on the other hand, it would have also solved a lot of problems. And it was not really given an opportunity to thrive or fail in the marketplace, largely because it got torpedoed internally by the legal departments at the major labels themselves. I mean, Warner could not sell a single other major label on the plan or a single ISP at the end of 18 months. And in fact, one of the great anecdotes that came out of my research about that story was that one of the meetings between the heads of the two largest major labels never happened because they couldn't get past an argument about whose office it would take place in. Right. So to me, the biggest obstacle to the content industry being able to profit in the era of ubiquitous information is their own self-immolation and not obstinacy, not idiocy, but rather structural resilience to innovation and change.
Can I, at the risk of advertising my own organization over and over, which of course I have to do, go to internetblueprint.org. We have two proposals, one that would essentially make it easier to go after folks that send frivolous DMCA notices, and another that would allow folks to sort of countersue for copyright abuse. But I just have to make one point about, I don't see this system as necessitating people lawyering up, okay, and having to hire a lawyer, okay? The appeals process is basically going to be a form and it's going to be implemented by the American Arbitration Association, which is, you know, you can hardly get a more credible group, okay? So, and, you know, I'm not necessarily, I'm sure I buy the digital divide argument. I don't use Tor or VPN, and I don't know how many, I mean, you're talking about like the top of the top of the technological elite, and I guess I'm not one of them. So I think you're overstating a little bit, you know, what kind of lawyering up people are going to do. And I think the goal, and certainly one of my goals, is try to make the appeals process as simple as possible. But the thing I don't really understand, and Molly, this gets to something that you said before, is would you prefer there's not an appeals process? I mean, with the notice and notice, or whatever it was called, sort of the prior incarnation of this notice system, there was no appeals process. There was no due process. Okay, you got these notices, and let's remind folks, under the terms of service of every single ISP, you can get kicked off. Okay, I'm not happy either. That is the one thing I did forget to say in my list of grievances of what I was not crazy about in the MOU, was I did want termination taken off the table. But now the major ISPs, most of them, have said publicly, we will not terminate our customers according to this plan. You think they want to kick their customers off? Of course they don't. And believe you me, I get in battles with ISPs all the time. So, I mean, I think I do really caution people, let's see how this thing is implemented before you pass judgment on how it really, really works.
Yeah, I wanted to say a couple of things and then also respond here. And building on something that Gigi, you said earlier, and well, actually, and you mentioned the issue of trust, I think part of the reason that there's such a suspicion and a lack of trust is because this is a purely private process. And it's hard to feel confident that someone's going to handle things appropriately if you have no ability to hold them accountable if they don't, or if they decide halfway through to change what's going on. So one of the things I would say in response to your question is some form of public oversight. Now, we don't have to go all the way to judicial review necessarily. We don't have to. I mean, part of the advantage of having a sort of extra legal system is to make it more flexible, right? When you try to deal with things like this with legislation, it's outdated, you know, half an hour after you pass it, right? So it's flexible, it can respond well, but completely private, I think, exacerbates some of the trust issues that people have in being confident that their grievances and concerns are going to be heard. So I would say that putting into play something like, here's the minimum that these kinds of systems can't go beyond. You can't terminate because it's a human right. I would say, you know, doing that in domestic law, we do have something to look at. International human rights law, I think, does provide sort of that Bill of Rights that you were talking about. We could draw on that. But being able, in a public fashion, to kind of set some of those minimums. And I see this not only relevant to this debate, but there's a number of different initiatives where we're calling for more network management, for more involvement, and to be able to just sort of set a baseline would be really helpful. And then the question about the, you know, would it be better not to have an appeal? I think more process is always better. I also teach civil procedure, right? But what concerns me is that there's sort of a tension between the stated educational purpose of the project and the fact that there are mitigation measures, right? If it were just about education, then sending the notices, sure, send the notices, tell people this is illegal. I mean, I think from an educative standpoint, simply telling people they're doing something that's illegal or that somebody in their household is serves that purpose very, very well. But to tie it to a sanction or a mitigation measure, right, to tie it to some kind of a consequence, I find that that is in some tension with the stated educational purpose, and it's at that point where I want to throw more procedure at it, right? Because it's having negative consequences.
I think that's really right. And
that is the point at which you get at the mitigation stage is when you get.
But then you also have the hassle stage. We all know that just merely, pardon me, nice people who came here, but calling your cable company is a mitigation itself. Being forced to deal with it, right? That's a mitigation. But I want to emphasize something Arun said really importantly. I think that the discussion has to happen at a level of principles. And I'll plug my book since you plug your organization, you plug your book, and your class. Is at the end I come around to saying that we have to have a discussion of principles about a right to connect, a right to speak, a right to assemble and act, that all bits are created equal, that the internet must remain open. And we have threats to our internet folks, not just from discussion like this. This is a discussion trying to happen, but it's far worse, I would argue, from government. That's why I'm a little concerned about government being an actor in this, because look at what's happening in the ITU, look at what's happening across much of Europe, look what's happening, Lord knows, in China and elsewhere. I think that we, the people of the net, you know, when you talk about a multi-stakeholder process here, it sounds like you, Gigi, are us.
Well, it's not enough, right?
Right, and so that's the issue, is that we, the us of the internet, have to have a discussion at a level of principles to talk about what it is we are protecting in this new society we're building, which goes back to your question. I think we have time, if I squeeze it in here for one more and then get out.
Yeah, if there are any questions, maybe we can just take them all real quick and then let you all answer them, okay? So
I think we have one there, and I think we're on the time. So, and the earlier questions here mainly were for the previous panel, so...
Michel Bizinski, InfoLoom. I just want to say that I am a little bit shocked by the disbalance in the discussion, and I want to go back to the privacy issue, because I think what we're talking about here is steal property. So the constant owners want to protect their property, and they want to be compensated for that, and that's normal. On the other hand, the users is giving away a lot of personal information, which has a lot of value and which is monetized without knowing anything about what's going on there. So there is also stolen property from the individuals, which is absolutely not transparent. There's no way to know where this is going. And I think the question of the trust that you were mentioning, it has to be balanced. I mean, it needs, if we were speaking of transparency, it has to be both ways. It has to be also where is my information going? Because otherwise, I don't see how the trust can be reestablished. And the other thing is that what do I want to say? Well, no, I think I will just stop there.
Any reaction there?
Well, sure. I mean, just on privacy, I mean, I think there are some questions about what happens to the data that's collected and so forth. But ultimately, this does start with the user going on to a public peer-to-peer network and making files available to the general public and making their IP address viewable that way. So I think the information that you start with is information that a user, by participating in this public forum, has chosen to put out there. So I think it's significant that's initially the information, and I was actually very glad that the way the program works, that's the information that the content companies get. They get the information that's available to anyone really on the peer-to-peer network, and that's what they give to the ISPs, and the ISPs do not share back with them, as I understand it, any personal information.
But that's why I asked the question before the previous panel about, so if I go through this process and I don't have a lawyer and I'm not very sophisticated, and I say, well, yeah, I share stuff, but less now than before. Is all of that discoverable if the content company chooses to sue later and I've just put myself in a position of liability? Because, yeah, privacy, not in this part of the process, but there's no privacy then in later parts of the process. That's my concern. Is there any answer to that in the... I've entered into a process where I'm told that it's all okay, it's cool, it's just a discussion. But I've said things that could be used against me.
So my understanding is that the agreement actually does contain a...
Is there a protection of that? That's what I'm asking, yeah.
Could you speak up, Victoria?
Sure. Can I have to go back and reread the MOU? But as I recall it, if we want to, we'd have to go through a normal subpoena. But whatever responses you give as part of the appeals process are only for the appeal and they cannot be used for anything.
Is that assured in there?
Yes, yes.
That's what I'm asking.
That is in the agreement, that's in black and white, yes.
All right, I think we're the hook. So thank you. Thank you, panel, very much. Thank you all, and we'll move on.
Thank you so much.
Wow, that was a great panel. We actually had a couple minutes built into our schedule for a break, but we just used it. So we're not having a break because that was too good to stop. If you have to step out and take a break, please do quietly. We're going to go ahead and move into the final panel. And actually, all of you could stay, if you don't mind, because this final panel includes everyone. So, and what we're going to do here is my colleague Konstantinos Komedis is going to come back and just facilitate this. But we're going to give everybody an opportunity to do a little wrap-up, and I'll turn it over to Konstantinos.
Oh, I see.
unfortunately, this lineup doesn't facilitate conversation that well.
So I do want to call back the original panelists, the first panelist, to come up and take a seat, please.
Okay, we only have 1 hour. We need to, actually less than 1 hour. We need to be out of here by 6 o'clock. So I thought that instead of asking questions and questions and questions, just to give the opportunity to each one of you basically to have some, to make some concluding remarks. 5 minutes each, I think, will be fine. The only one thing that I think I picked up from today's discussion, which I thought was fantastic, was that, and what I heard the questions and the second panel, especially referring to, was the issue of trust. And the issue of trust, we see it actually happening not only in the context of intellectual property, it's in the issue of privacy, security, even at the governance level. So I would like to start with far right here and ask, you know, for some concluding remarks, and if you can also address the issue of trust, that would be great, how basically the system will make sure that users will be able to trust the system to make the right decisions and move forward, because we've all heard that this is a far better idea compared at least to what we saw at the level of SOPA and PIPA. So please, you have the floor. Thanks.
Okay. Yeah, I actually thought the dialogue in that panel was very good, and I understand the trust issue. I think that's an important point. On that, I guess there are three things I would say that we try to build into this system that try to address that. One is transparency, and you saw this recently where there was a concern expressed in, I think, a blog or some kind of a thing on the internet saying that one of the companies that was used to do the review of the content company's tracking or monitoring system might have done some work for the content community at some time as a lobbyist. So we immediately talked about that and said, let's have another independent review of the work that was done. I don't think anybody's been selected yet, but we did immediately say, you know, that I didn't look that deeply at the allegation, but the concern was, look, it's out there, and there's concerns that have been built up on that. So we need to take a look at that and do something quickly to make sure people know we're serious about this. So I think that does show we're serious about it. Secondly, we did put into this system an advisory board. Gigi's on it. Some other advocates are on it, too. Obviously, that alone isn't enough, but because we're going to be very transparent, hopefully the Internet Society and members here who have heard about this will be helpful as well. So hopefully the crowdsourcing that we usually expect on the Internet will be a part of the process. Certainly, as the notices begin to go out, I expect that there will be occasionally some people have concerns raised in that process, and that will be another learning tool for all of us. So I think that's another part of it. Third, David raised at Sohn, I think, some good questions or concerns he had. And one of the things he talked about, for example, was the fact that the system might actually may not be working that well, and we need to have some way to correct that. And again, we built into the process a review, so it won't just be a one-time review of the monitoring system. It'll be a regular review. So we'll look at it again to say, is it still working? And part of that will be taking that data and internally at least looking at it and saying, is there something here that shows there's a problem here? So I think on the trust area, we try to do as much as we could. Recognize it's something that people are, see as something that's unfamiliar to some extent, even though, again, it's been out there for a while. So we're going to have some time. I think we need some time to actually make it work and prove itself. And I think that's the most I would like to ask you to do is not trust, but actually give us some time to make it work and earn the trust by actually making the process effective. David also raised one other point, which I think is a good one, and I don't think there's a real answer to it, but we're going to try, and that is, how do you assure you reach the people? One of the reasons that we have the notice system we have, including the pop-up and so forth, is because we do want to try to make as much effort as we can to get the attention of people. It's an education process. And I do believe a lot of the instances where these kinds of things happen are in group homes where people are living together and somebody has the account, the other folks are using it, and something's going on that the person who has the account doesn't even know is going on. And then certainly it happens with parents and their kids. So, you know, the continuous process of sending out the notices, the pop-up, and the mitigation phase at the end, again, is just to say, get your attention. Would you please acknowledge us either yes or no? And that, I think, is another way we're trying to make sure we get through as much as we can. There's no perfect system. I agree with that. And even the voicemails we're going to be sending to people, I don't think are going to get to everybody either. I know in my case, voicemail is sort of last century. I don't even check it as much as I used to. So, but it's, again, an attempt to be as broad as we can in terms of making sure we get the notices into people who need to know what's going on. So I think those are the points I've made. The only other thing I would add, again, is that I do think that, you know, one of the things we were trying to do as we built this system is to try to be as fair as we could and putting as many mechanisms as we could into it that both make sure people are educated and have a chance to go find out more about the process and about copyright and so forth, and find legal sources of copyright legal material. And in fact, if you go to the CCI site, when it gets full up and running, you'll see that. It's got a lot of notices, a lot of places where you can go to get content and so forth. So it really is education-focused, and I hope it makes a difference.
Thank you very much. Fernando?
Thank you. And I thought that the prior panel was excellent, and also, again, want to thank you for having us here, and Paul and David. It's important not only to be here to talk and explain ourselves, but also to be accountable to you and to get the feedback. I was furiously writing down notes. There's no way that I can, in 5 minutes, follow Link, who's been at this for a while and is very eloquent, and I think you also had some very good points. But I will say the following, which I was scribbling down while Link was talking, so if I repeat him, you know. This is a process. Part of the process is getting your feedback. Part of the process is also hearing from you as we are rolling this out. We want to get it right because it's important. We know it's important to our customers that we get it right because they rely on us, and they're relying on us to provide a service that they value, and that's important to them. We are here trying to make it work. We expect to learn, and I think that it's important that people understand that, because this is not about having a perfect system and imposing it. The MOU expressly provides for revisions and for feedback, for data gathering, for education of the participants as well. And it's important for me to tell you, it's important for my company to tell you, that we take that seriously. We expect to learn. The second thing is along the lines of learning. Again, this is an educational program. I heard a lot of comments about extreme cases. We're not trying to target extreme cases here. We are trying to educate the vast, you know, majority of internet users for whom a cultural change is a hard thing, and to be constructive about it. So we're not trying to catch the person who, you know, is in an extreme use case, difficult to track down. Well, they can get around it. They're not going to be convinced, hard-hearted. This is about education. And again, you know, at the end of the process, we're not planning as a result of this to terminate customers. We're hoping the result is that we have more educated customers. And then finally, a point about language. I think it's great, you know, that that Gigi pointed this out, and I was following a little bit of the Twitter back and forth about how it's not constructive to talk in terms of pirates and thieves, and I agree with that. I don't think that that is constructive at all. I also think it's important in engaging all of this that, you know, we don't talk about condemning businesses for trying to do things in a moderated way, especially in an environment where we can all agree that there are, you know, far worse consequences, far worse outcomes, and trying to cooperate. You know, we're not trying to be models of the best and the brightest, but we also would appreciate if we got some understanding for attempting to do what's in our customers' and in our business's best interest in a constructive way, which includes this feedback, and I appreciate it. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Fernando. Jill, thanks.
Thank you. So I just want to echo what both Fernando and Link have said about how valuable it has been to be here and to listen to this dialogue and to, you know, follow what's been asked and said on the internet during it. And I think that the level of skepticism that we hear is neither surprising nor unwarranted. And we are, as my colleagues have said, you know, really hope that one of the things that this audience and other audiences can do can to some degree hold judgment in abeyance until the program is up and running, which we hope will be very, very soon. Because we do hope that the proof is in the pudding. And, you know, again, we don't have that level of trust at the moment among the various constituencies here, and therefore asking for trust is not probably the best way to proceed, but sort of waiting and watching and giving feedback and hoping that not only do we do it right the first time, but that we continue to hone the system. But from my perspective, the more important piece that I want to talk about here, which has not been the subject of this discussion, is really CCI, the organization that I'm in charge of, because we have two mandates, and one is to help get the copyright alert system up and running. But for me, the more important and the more long-lasting and hopefully the more far-reaching aspect of what we're trying to do is to engage in a productive education effort around these issues. That doesn't mean to find a new way to preach about the protection of copyright, but it does mean talking about being an ethical user of the internet. What is it? As the internet grows up, how can we all engage, not just in the area of copyrighted content, but across the whole internet? What are the expectations of engaging in an ethical way, and how do we describe that, and how do we begin that dialogue with a bunch of different stakeholders? The other is, and we are in the process of partnering with a couple of nonprofit organizations around creating curricula for kids starting in kindergarten about, you know, what does creativity mean? What is the value of having some control over your creative content, and what are the, you know, the rights and responsibilities around that? And so, you know, my challenge is to both take a system that is about identifying allegedly negative behavior and trying to change that behavior, but doing so under a rubric of messaging and educational materials and interfacing with consumers in partnership with our advisory board in a way that sort of evolves this social norm I talked about earlier to something that allows everyone to win. You know, consumers get the content they want in a compelling format, at either for free in many cases or at a reasonable price, in a variety of different venues and on a variety of different devices and whenever and wherever they want it. And our expectations around content are 21st century expectations. They're not the expectations that I have, you know, a den downstairs with 55,000 CDs in my collection. Our kids growing up today are creating different expectations and growing up in a different world. So I hope that in addition to focusing on getting the copyright alert system right, this group with input from a variety of different constituencies can also get the advocacy and education around the importance of these issues right.
Thank you very much, Jill. Victoria?
Thank you for your time and for listening about the MOU and the copyright alert system. We appreciate your feedback and do take it seriously. We appreciate the feedback that this group has given us in the past. I'm sure that will give us again in the future. We're trying to make it work. We're trying to be sensitive to the privacy concerns and other concerns that are raised. Will we make mistakes? Possibly. We hope that they will be identified and corrected. Our goal is to get users to think about what are legitimate alternatives to music, I mean, to access music legitimately. To that end, RIAA and NARM and one other group, I believe, announced today a website called www.whymusicmatters.com. It is a guide to licensed music services in the United States It is not all of them, but it is several of the ones that have been licensed by at least three of the major labels in the United States. We hope that you will use that as a resource in thinking about where you'd like to go to get legitimate music. Thank you.
Thanks, Vicki. As I was listening to the last panel, there was a lot of interesting discussion about a lot of perfectly legitimate issues involving human rights, involving privacy, involving fair use. I don't want to repeat what everyone has said, but I just want to very quickly address several things that I heard in the last panel, just to clarify what this system is about and what it's not about. First is mashups. My colleagues and I at the movie studios have endlessly interesting fair use debates about what sort of mashups are fair use and which are not. This system does not involve mashups. This system is meant to identify people who share entire copies of movies or television shows or songs. If it works as designed, it will not catch anything remotely resembling a mashup. If we misidentify something and accidentally ensnare a mashup, I'm sure we will hear about it very soon. Second was...
from these guys.
I have no doubt we will hear about it. Second thing is there was mention of deep packet inspection. This system has nothing to do with deep packet inspection. The only thing we will be inspecting is the shared folders that people use... that is basically installed on somebody's computer when they join one of these peer-to-peer networks and basically decide that they're going to, quote-unquote, share their files with everybody else, potentially millions of other anonymous people on the internet. This is something that we could look at today, something we could look at last year, something that we could look at whether or not this whole copyright alert system works. It has nothing to do with deep packet inspection. And the third thing I just want to address, again, very briefly, is privacy, because... This may have gotten buried, but I just want to, it's worth re-emphasizing. Throughout this system, when we identify those who are distributing files through peer-to-peer system, we will not know their names. We will not know any identifying information. The only thing that we will know is the IP address, which again, anybody in this room could figure out by just joining a peer-to-peer network. We will not even know their names or other identifying information about them if they choose to file an appeal. There's one narrow exception to that, which got mentioned before, but again, it bears repeating, is that if somebody says, 20th Century Fox authorized me to distribute Avatar through peer-to-peer, and they say, here's a document that says I can do something, it says, you know, Ben Sheff, you know, I say, oh, you know what, I have a letter from Ron Wheeler at 20th Century Fox saying that Ben Sheffner has the authority to distribute this through peer-to-peer, and I submit that as part of the appeal. 20th Century Fox has a right to look up and see in their files whether, oh, yes, of course, we actually have a record of having done that. Whether that
unless
actually
it's fraudulent.
Unless it's and they have every right to challenge and say it's fraudulent. That's the one extremely narrow, to the point of non-existent, scenario where somebody's name could actually be resolved. This system respects privacy, and it, in 99.99% of the cases, the person's identity will never, ever be shared with the copyright owner.
Thank you. Ron, please.
Rather than repeat some of the excellent comments been made, I'm going to make one additional point that I don't believe has been made. There was, on the last panel, a discussion about whether it was necessary or appropriate to have mitigation measures in addition to the notices, and isn't it sufficiently educative to just send notices? Well, you know what? One of the purposes of this program, from my perspective, is actually to find out what is the correct answer to that statement. Because certainly, from our perspective, the concern has always been about on notice and notice programs. And as you may know, there's going to be one in Canada as a result of the new Canadian copyright law that was just passed over the summer, is that they do not have educational value because the recipients of the notices are fully aware that there are no consequences to them. So the concern we've always had is if you get a notice that you know will be followed by exactly nothing, and it says have a nice day at the end, that you may not change your behavior, and therefore and if that's true, then we would be seeing lots of notices that weren't responded to. On the other hand, if you have a program where there are reasonable mitigation measures, and there's been a debate about what measures are reasonable and which ones are not, but if there is a program where I'm told that here's a notice, and if you keep getting these and don't change your behavior, then something will happen to you or to the account to which you're using, then our belief has always been that you're more likely to change your behavior in response to the notice. In other words, to indicate that you have been successfully educated. But that time will tell. What we're really hoping to see from this is that one or two notices results in change of behavior. Our goal would be that their mitigation measures would never be necessary, because it shows that notice alone is sufficient. And believe me, we will take that into account. We know how controversial mitigation measures are. The French program has been mentioned a few times. It's obviously a very strict. Series of measures there. Actually, no one's lost their internet access, but someone did receive a fine within the last month. So we know how controversial. If they turn out not to be necessary to resolve the changes of behavior, believe me, we will forego mitigation measures. But that day has not arrived yet. I don't think it is a matter of trust us or trust the program or anything like that. But wait and see. Let's all wait and see and learn together. Thank you.
Thanks, Ron.
So thank you all for spending 3 hours talking about this. I think it's been really great, and I know I've learned a lot. So I'm going to put a pox on the houses of both the ISPs and the movie companies, because in various and sundry policy battles, I mean, we're up against them, and they don't always work in the most transparent environment. I mean, they're used to smoky rooms, and they're used to talking to legislators one-on-one. And somebody said to me, I don't remember who it was, well, this is a private agreement. It's between companies. So who has the right to complain? It was essentially the implication. And I said, this is not your typical commercial agreement. Okay, this is one that is heavily scrutinized. At the beginning, I think there was the heavy hand of government. You can thank your Governor Cuomo for that. But despite a lot of conspiracy theories, the White House really didn't have a whole lot to do with this. But they were certainly kept in the loop, and they continue to be kept in the loop. So there is some sort of government aspect to this. And I think there needs to be serious oversight. I mean, the implementation of an advisory board, I think, is one important step. So this is not a commercial agreement like all other commercial agreements. It is one that has oversight, and it's one that, frankly, needs your help, okay? So I'm asking you guys right here and now, when this thing kicks off, if there are problems, you need to let me know. You need to let Jerry Berman know and Jules Polonetsky, my other colleagues on the advisory board, because that's what we're here for. We're here to make sure this thing gets implemented fairly. So we talked a lot about trust. We talked a lot about energy. Put your energy into making sure this thing is not going away, okay? As much as some people in this room might like that to happen, it's not going away. I love the folks that say, call your broadband provider and tell them you'll go somewhere else. I mean, that's the other half of my work. They take nobody else to go to. So let's try to make this work, and please do use me and the other folks on the advisory board As mechanisms to make sure that this thing is implemented fairly. Thanks.
Thank you, Jay-Z.
I would reiterate everything that Gigi just said, which I thought was right on the money. On top of that, I would close with two quick points. I'm very skeptical, as I've already indicated, about this system working. Number one, because I think that BitTorrent and the P2P model, as we think about it, is really last decade's answer to this issue, and the range of ways in which people share content freely, licensed, unlicensed, and otherwise, has become such a kaleidoscopic variety that trying to close down one channel, it's like trying to stop people from getting into New York by closing the Holland Tunnel. Right? There are so many other ways. You're going to end up where, to use another metaphor, it's like the Dutch boy sticking his fingers in the dike and hoping to hold off the flood that way. So that's a serious problem that you guys haven't addressed, and the reason that you haven't addressed is because it can't be addressed, right? The number of channels is continuing to proliferate. The only way that that can be stopped is if there are some very severe mitigation measures at the network level, which clearly for political reasons and ethical reasons, the ISPs and the content industries are not willing to pursue at this point. And that's a very good thing for all of us. But I also just, and nobody's mentioned this yet, I think it's very important. Over and over and over again, it's been pointed out that the purpose of this policy is education. And it's not entirely clear to me that the problem here is that the consumer base is uneducated, right? Now, the cynical response to that is to say, well, the consumers have been educated by 40,000 people getting sued by the RIAA, tens of thousands more getting sued by the MPAA, all kinds of one after another Keystone Cops style, you know, shooting yourself in the foot public relations disasters. That's the cynical response. But there's also another response to it, which I think is equally important. You know, when I do these surveys of people's activities online, I also ask them open-ended questions, like, what are your feelings about remixes and mashups and things like that? And what I get out of that is this really interesting glimpse into the ethical frameworks that people use when they try to make sense of these emerging cultural practices. And when I first started doing this particular set of research back in the mid-2000s, 2006, I think, was the first survey, copyright was completely off of respondents' radars. It was a wonky legal issue that if anybody knew anything about it, whatever they knew was wrong, right? When I refielded the survey most recently, about a year and a half ago, copyright rose to the top of the level of concerns reported by respondents about their activities online. And the primary way that they addressed copyright was acknowledging that it is a broken regulatory system that does not address the ethical frameworks that they have developed for themselves around the disposition of cultural information online. So I'm not saying that we need to tear down copyright and rebuild it from the ground up. But what I'm saying is that systems that begin with the premise that consumers, you know, if we can only get to them and explain to them that what they're doing is wrong, I think that is a policy that's destined to fail, because consumers have, in not just the geeky types, but in very large numbers, majorities perhaps, have already made up their minds about these issues and have kind of moved on and developed their own systems for parsing right from wrong. And until you engage those ethical frameworks that they've actually developed for themselves, you're not going to have a persuasive argument, even assuming you manage to get their attention for 10 seconds.
Thank you. David?
So as I said, initially, I guess my overall read is that if this thing works as advertised, it doesn't have to have dire consequences. I do see in this agreement what looks to be a good faith effort to build in some safeguards and some process. As has been said multiple times here, I don't think that means people should just trust it'll all work. We're going to have to wait and see. We're going to have to watch it carefully. I think one of the reasons that one could be optimistic at the outset is that they chose to bring in people like Gigi for the advisory board, right? They could have easily stocked an advisory board with a bunch of yes men or yes women who share the perspective of the industry that put the agreement together, and they chose not to do that. They brought in people not just Gigi, but also Jerry Berman, who's the founder of my organization. They brought in folks who are going to be willing to ask hard questions, and that is at least a positive sign for how it might go forward on implementation. In terms of effectiveness and this question of whether, you know, does education really help solve the problem? Are users really open to being educated on this topic in a way that would actually reduce infringement? It's an interesting question. I guess my view is that it's worth thinking about what success would look like for this program. And I guess to me, I assume that there is some substantial set of consumers out there for whom that's absolutely right. They have lots of different channels for possible infringement. The education here won't affect them much one way or the other. They either might move to something that isn't peer-to-peer, or they'll ignore the notices or what have you. My hypothesis would be that there is, though, also a substantial subset of users who either don't fully understand copyright law, don't know that their behavior on some of these networks is observable, or don't know that it's really the 15-year-old in the house who's doing all this, and that if the parents were to find out what Junior's been doing, they would do something to try to rein that in. So I guess that's why I'm optimistic that there's the potential for some reduction in infringement here. Certainly, the program only goes to those folks who are amenable to to having their behavior changed through some education and through more information, and that is, I suspect, some, but obviously not all of the population.
Thank you, David. Jeff, would you like to say something?
So I'm gratified to have created the trending hashtag of the day in trust. And I think that does remain an issue, but I still think there's a bigger issue even than that. And I'm not sure we know what business we're in. We certainly don't know what the internet is yet. And we're trying to regulate it and define it by the legacy. I'm fond of pointing out that Elizabeth Eisenstein, a key scholar in Gutenberg, says that we didn't really know what the book was. It didn't take on its own form until 50 years after it was created. There's an area of great creativity here, and that goes also to the business models. In my end of the media and content business, the news business, which has been, of course, terribly disrupted, I'm coming to argue to my folks that maybe we're not in the content business at all, that we should see ourselves in the service business, the relationship business, and data about that. And that's something that Google and Facebook understand that we don't understand. We still think we make a thing because that's what we had to do to get our service out there before. And as an author of sorts, having done two books, either of which I will sell you, I will also say that I don't make most of the money from that. I make money from getting some speaking gigs and things like that. So I really need not so much copyright, but credit right. That when my ideas get out there, what I want is provenance and links back to me, and ethical behavior on the internet, please spread what I say, agree with it or disagree with it, nicely, please, and link back to me and give provenance to me so that I can then get credit in the conversation, I can be part of the conversation, I can maybe get a gig out of it, whatever I choose to do to exploit that. And I think that thus we see people like me finding new business models because we have to. And I would say with respect to the entertainment industry that some bright kid in the garage will, by God, or in something called YouTube, will create entertainment and create models that take advantage of abundance over scarcity. And that do not try to make a business model anymore out of fighting your customers, fighting people who like you. And just as Gigi asks us in the internet to be positive and to go toward new things and new fair use and such, I would challenge you in your industries, and I used to be part of it, to be positive in the sense of saying, how can we find ways, and you will disrupt the business models you have. You will disrupt the windows of distribution you have. You will piss off some people as you already have. But if you give your fans, and these are people who want to watch your stuff, if you give your fans the ability to buy your stuff when and where and how they want to, I have to believe that is the key to business success. It's disruptive. Well, welcome to the club. I can tell you about it from the newspaper business that we're disrupted and that by trying to protect the old, it didn't work worth a damn. And what we have to do is change our businesses, disrupt our own businesses. And I will say as a university person, what I'm concentrating on right now is a strategy process for my school because of accreditation, which I can't stand. And what we're trying to do right now is to imagine our own disruption, imagine the school that would disrupt us and destroy us. We're only 6 years old. Well, I would say the same challenge exists for all of us here. This is the internet. This is the new reality. Disrupt yourselves. Don't just protect the past.
Thank you, Jeff. We have 5-10 minutes for some last-minute comments, but before I open the floor, I would just like to say that we believe at the Internet Society that multi-stakeholder dialogue, and I've mentioned that before, is very important, and I was very glad to hear Jill in particular mentioning, and everybody else mentioning, that the system envisioned some sort of dialogue. It was based on the dialogue. That's why they brought people like Gigi that everybody was mentioning. Now the challenge is to continue this dialogue, and it is to find a way to make the system work and to hear everybody, the businesses, the ISPs. I'm sure that this is a learning curve, and many issues issues will emerge, other issues will be resolved, some issues will not be resolved. So the challenge right now is to identify ways in order to bring everybody together and to make this a more inclusive framework. As I said, this discussion today for me is just the beginning, and we as the Internet Society, we will facilitate and continue having these discussions. And with that note, I would like to ask some final remarks. I know that Jolly also wants to say something, so please identify yourself. Thanks.
Hi, my name is Daniel Ressler, and one of the things that I see kind of missing from the panel right now is, okay, so we got the music industry and the movie industry, but one of the big content providers nowadays is video games and interactive entertainment. And I want to ask, have they been approached? Because I know that they're making a lot of innovative techniques and business models to get that content in an easy, serviceable manner out to their public. Have they been contacted and asked for advice on how to implement something like this? For example, the Steam network that Valve Software runs is a very successful marketplace for proprietary content. And so that's what I want to ask the panel, who are, I guess, actually implementing the system, not necessarily the advocates.
We do work with ESA, the Entertainment Software Association, that represents most of the video game makers. So we talk to them fairly often about what are content protection measures that work or don't work in their industry, and also what are legitimate distribution models that work and don't work. Today, the U.S. record industry is over 50% digital in sales. We have been highly disrupted by the internet. The labels are working very hard to come up with new distribution models over the internet. If you go to whymusicmatters.com, you'll see that there are over 50 different business models, stores right now, that will sell you or give you access to music in a variety of different matters, where you want, when you want, how you want it. That doesn't even include the over 2,000 online music radio stations right now, like Pandora, iHeartRadio, SiriusXM, which has, you know, webcasting as well as its satellite radio and others.
Jolly?
I want to talk about sharing. You mentioned sharing, and something I heard Stuart Copeland of The Police say once about music, and he said, it's not about me, it's about us. And so sharing is a very natural thing, and by trying to inhibit it, is an unnatural act, and it would seem that it would be better to like find ways of exploiting it rather than restricting it. And getting more onto the point of sharing, I heard you say that the policy is you want to find what you're going to find, people's shared folders, Ben said this, and find what's in them, and for people who are sharing. So I'm wondering if you could just clarify how the policy affects people who are sharing or just people who are downloading. And so, you know, for instance, with BitTorrent, you can throttle your seeding as against your downloading. So if one were to throttle your seeding down to zero and not be sharing anything, would that be some kind of defense?
I mean, when Mark Monitor is basically scanning the internet and scanning these peer-to-peer networks, when they look inside somebody's share folder, what they are seeing is somebody distributing.
Excuse me, but with BitTorrent, you do not see in people's share folders. All you see is what files they are BitTorrenting. And you cannot tell whether they're actually uploading those files unless they actually upload to you.
Well, that's what they're doing.
Well, your description was inaccurate.
I think you were talking about LimeWire,
where we're talking about BitTorrent.
Well, in BitTorrent, when you're in a swarm, my understanding is you're simultaneously uploading and downloading, unless you throttle yourself to the where you're talking about. And the Mark Monitor program for the BitTorrent protocol is looking at the swarm and looking at the distribution from the swarm. So it is looking at distribution.
And it is, in fact, downloading, depending on whether it was the first time this particular file had been detected, they actually are downloading either all or part of it to verify, in fact, that this person.
So if you set your seeding to zero, which you can, you're presumably immune from Mark Monitor.
If you're not distributing, then you won't be detected.
So if you're just plainly downloading, you're out.
Yeah.
You're clean.
Yeah.
Yep.
Thanks, Jolly. David.
Don't worry about it. Well, you're all good.
Yeah, you know who I am. I'm going to just restate what some things that Aram and Jeff brought up earlier. Let's look into the mind of our pirate who we're all really mad at, supposedly. This is a person who likes your content that you're creating, and they may be stealing, but they are out of pocket donating disk space and bandwidth, and they are acting as a volunteer to distribute your content. You pay people to distribute your content, but you've got people volunteering to do this. So it seems to me that you need another business model where you can handle the royalty problem, but not alienate those people and get them to work for you.
I'll take that, because a number of people have been giving us advice on business models. And with all due respect, I think we know a little bit more about running our business than people the average man in the street. Whether if we're forced to change our business model because the old one that delivered returns to our shareholders of a certain amount, of course we will. We have entire teams of people creating new business models, as Vicky talked about. Same is true in the movie business. But we actually have to be the ones to tell our shareholders that it's a good idea for them to own stock in our company. So just saying things like, ad-supported movies, it's a great idea. We'll never make another Avatar with ad-supported movies. You have to pencil it out, and this is our business. So look, we're not against changing our business. We've changed our business a million times over the years, not as fast as other people want, but there's always a reason why we decided not to do one thing or another. And that's true. It's the nature of capitalism. You can object to capitalism, but that's the shareholders demand.
Oh, come on.
What do you mean?
Come on. If people are trying to think, listen, this is a time when there are new models. How's your newspaper business working, sir? Great, isn't it? Right? If people have suggestions for you and your business and say things, and you just dismiss them because you're so much smarter than the rest.
I did not dismiss them. I just said we probably know a little bit more about running a newspaper business than the average person in the street.
Oh, it's going great.
It's going great. Are you going to guarantee we're going to make more money if we follow your advice?
I don't know, but I know there are different models and comforts to do it. I run a separate.
Of course, there are different models. We can give away our content for free.
Okay,
and we put out a tip jar. But seriously, people think those are one of the suggestions we get.
You're dismissing.
I'm not dismissing anything. I'm only saying please cut us some slack. You don't have to trust us. It's not about trust, but please understand that we are not inherently opposed to new business models, but we do insist that they pencil out. And there's nothing wrong with that. I make no apologies for saying that they have to pencil out for us and for our shareholders.
But that's not how the
Sorry, we're running out of time, and there are a couple of other comments, so I'm sorry to be cutting
you. Try and be brief, and I won't bring up Jack Valenti's claim that the VCR was going to
Yes,
like the Boston Strangler. But I want to.
Don't I because we're running out of time.
Sure, you don't want
I want to apologize.
Are you
for
sure?
Being,
You're
I
do, sure you don't want to bring it up.
I don't want to bring that up. I want to apologize for being flip earlier, but let me try and make it more explicit. What I was trying to get across is that the content industry has now is asking people to restrict the way they use their internet connection and not allow them to share it wirelessly with their neighborhood, with people on the street. They're asking for that. In exchange, there's nobody that has brought up the idea that maybe we should examine life of the author plus 70 years as a ridiculously long term for copyright, which was not how the copyright system evolved. This is not a natural system. This is a man-made system. And so this notion of fairness, it just seems we're already talking about an end game which seems reasonable given where you started from, but from where I sit seems wholly unreasonable.
Can I just thanks any reactions, but this is about the copyright alert system, so please try to limit your comments on
Internet
this
Blueprint
system.
Proposes rolling back copyright terms. Sign up for it. And be Please. Active. Be active on the Hill where these changes can actually be made.
Hi. My name is Jay Sulzberger, and I have occasionally sent an email for the past 40 years, maybe more. I'm getting old. I don't know anything about the proposal except what I read late last night when I was alerted to this panel. I probably am misunderstanding something. The proposal is that ISPs would look inside my packets and read what's inside. That's wiretapping.
No.
Oh, it's no, wait a second. I feel much better. Wait, okay. let me finish the sentence. So you're just going to do traffic analysis?
No.
That's all?
No.
Well, then how possibly can you tell whether or not somebody is perhaps committing copyright infringement by sending me some bootalicious video, God, about it, dated 10 years ago. How do you tell if you don't violate, and guess what? They haven't all been repealed. The wiretap laws. That's all.
As I understand it, as a peer-to-peer user,
right,
I am voluntarily going onto the network,
right,
and voluntarily exposing my IP address.
Sure.
And the files.
And distributing files,
right,
to the public.
Right. And you might commit a copyright violation. And the way that's shown is somebody from the Inglobulator's secret police / copyright violator's snare system asks you for something which you don't have a license to redistribute. And then they go to court. And then you say, this person has committed a copyright violation by sending me this thing that is not freely licensed. That's the mechanism, right?
No.
I'm following what you just said. I misunderstood it, doubtless. So how do you know that somebody might be committing copyright violation without wiretapping? Because why is it okay to wiretap?
This question has actually been litigated. And there's right. No right of privacy when you're basically creating this file,
right,
exposing it.
Well, then we really need to get people to more encrypt so we can get together and overthrow this government. Don't be ridiculous. The United States has a lady in the harbor, right? And the people came over here because they wouldn't get the knock after midnight and come in and then take them away or beat them to death on the spot. As far as I can tell, copyright violation doesn't deserve to destroy the internet.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you very much for being here until this late. And I will just give the floor now to Paul for some concluding remarks. Thanks.
This has been really an outstanding event. I hope that everyone has found it to be very educational. I certainly have. We have some really...
It's been education for me.
It has. Especially loved the questions, the participation from the audience. By the way, we've had great online viewership through the entire event, so we've reached a large audience with this. We're going to be archiving this. It's going to be subtitled, so this will be very helpful to anyone that has questions going forward about this system. We would like to follow up with you all at a future point in time, maybe after this system has been fully launched and operational, just to touch base and see how things are going. I think that would be very appropriate. I've already got interest from our Washington, D.C. chapter, our San Francisco Bay chapter, so I'm not sure where the venue will be, but you can count on it that we're going to be here to have events like this on this topic and others. So thank you all very much for being here. We do have refreshments, so we have about an hour of refreshments, and that is, where is it?
On the second floor.
On the second floor, okay.
Elevator and follow the signs.
There is another event in this room immediately following this, so I please ask you to just clean up your area and make sure it looks nice and neat. Thank you all.
Thank you.